gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week of July 21st. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And more radical info can be found on the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history, starting July 21st, 1916, U.S. Marines land in Haiti again to protect American interests. They'll go back again and again as well, the U.S. having a lot of interest to protect.
The men and women in our armed forces protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interests of the wealthy few.
Also on July 21st, 1954, the Geneva Accords are signed, ending the French colonization of French Indochina, a place also known as Vietnam. The U.S. discovering that the French might not be interested, but by God, the U.S. must have some special interest in Vietnam. Within a year, they'll have our first military advisors setting the stage for the Vietnam War. Also on July 1st, 1972, George Carlin is charged with disorderly conduct for performing his famous Seven Words Act in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
There are two things that I blame for the abysmal condition of this magnificent species that had such potential at one time, and that is religion and commerce. And those are the two things that hinder us here. I mean, the religious people say this is immoral, it is corrupting, and it will do bad things to your character if you even hear these words as a child or a grown-up or whatever. And commerce says if you say these things, the customers and the advertisers are going to run from you.
This week in radical history for July 22nd.
On this day, July 22nd, in 1863, American frontiersman Kit Carson was ordered by the military governor of New Mexico to get rid of the entire Navajo Nation. At first, Carson was shocked by the brutal nature of this plan and attempted to resign his position. But after being pressured to stay, he obediently began the forced removal of the Navajo people from their land. First, Carson and his men implemented a scorched earth policy, burning Navajo fields and homes and stealing their livestock. Carson then began attacking the Navajo strongholds that fought in resistance until the Navajo were forced to surrender. A few months later, 8,000 Navajos were forced to march 300 miles to Fort Sumner, where they were imprisoned for the next 4 years. Over 300 people died during the long walk, and many more died in imprisonment. This is just one of the many brutal atrocities committed against indigenous populations in the land of the free.
Also on July 22, 1938, Joe Louis defeats German boxer Max Schmeling. Because of the Nazi persecution of the Jews in Europe and Hitler's disdain for blacks, the fight had a mystic proportions, with Louis seen by many as fighting to uphold democracy and the race. He succeeded convincingly, ending the fight in the first round. Also on July 22, 1970, during the Alcatraz occupation by Indians of all tribes, the first child was born on the first freed Native American piece of land in the 20th century. Also on this date in 1995 in Israel, four foreign activists break padlocks and reopen the main gates to the Palestinian Hebron University in the West Bank, closed by Israeli security and occupation forces back in 1987.
On this day, July 23rd, in 1846, writer and philosopher Henry David Thoreau was thrown in jail for refusing to pay his $1 poll tax in protest of American slavery and the Mexican-American War. Thoreau had resisted his poll tax for 6 years because he did not support the government's use of the money. Although he was only in jail for one night, the experience deeply impacted him, and he began speaking out about the responsibility of individuals to hold their government accountable. 3 years later, Thoreau wrote Civil Disobedience, an essay explaining how the actions of the American government were controlled by only a few individuals rather than the people. Thoreau's essay was highly influential to many activists.
Also on this day, July 23rd, 1892, strikers battled Pinkerton thugs during the Carnegie Steel Strike in Homestead, Pennsylvania, as the Pinkertons, trying to import and protect scabs, opened fire on striking steel workers. In the ensuing battle, 3 Pinkertons and 11 Strikers and spectators are shot dead. Strikers militantly resisted the private goons hired by Henry Clay Frick to dislodge him from the plant grounds. They fought back with guns and homemade cannon. The strike, however, lasted for 4 months, but the company was able to restore production as winter approached and morale declined. Anarchist Alexander Berkman, on this day, would enter Frick's office and shoot him, trying to revenge the deaths of the strikers. As a side note, later in the year, Emma Goldman would horsewhip her old mentor, Johann Most, for shit-talking Berkman's attempt. She horsewhipped him on stage and broke the whip afterwards. Also on July 23, 1908, Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite Henry Ford would sell his first Model T. On July 30, 1938, Hitler presented the highest non-citizen award, Grand Cross, the Supreme Order of the German Eagle, to Henry Ford in Berlin. U.S. Senate reports in 1974 on Ford Motor Company's aid to Nazi war effort. Have you driven your Ford in support of the Nazis lately? Also on July 23, 1967, starts out of Detroit upheavals, 7 days of social unrest, fighting with cops, anti-business, anti-government actions, including looting, results in 43 dead, 2,000 wounded, and 5,000 made homeless. Largest U.S. riots in a century, sparks additional riots throughout the United States. Also on this date in 1968, police kill 7 in standoff with black nationalists in Cleveland, Ohio, triggering days of riots and 4 more deaths. Lastly, on July 23, 2004, preemptive harassment as FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force investigate info shops and anarchists throughout the country. In Lawrence, Columbia, Kirksville, Topeka, and St. Louis, agents served several anarchists with subpoenas, ordering them to report to the grand jury on the same day they were planning to go to Boston to protest the Democratic National Convention. Let freedom ring. This day in radical history for July 24th, labor organizer Mary Harris Mother Jones begins the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Theodore Roosevelt Summer Hole in Oyster Bay, Long Island, New York, to publicize the harsh conditions of child labor in Philadelphia textile mills. When Mother Jones first visited Philadelphia, she found child workers as young as 10-year-old with stooped shoulders and missing fingers and hands. In response, she organized the march. Mary Harris Mother Jones led striking children from Kennington Textile Mills in Pennsylvania on a 17-day march from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, where they hoped to confront Roosevelt in his summer home. About 300 men, women, and children were led by 3 children dressed as Revolutionary War soldiers. Along the way, they raised awareness of child laborers with rallies in eastern Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, and won the hearts of many. When Mother Jones and her army arrived in Coney Island, she was asked to speak. The result of the speech was The Wail of the Children, which is delivered today. When they reached Oyster Bay on July 29th, where Teddy Roosevelt was vacationing, he refused to see them. Our beloved Teddy Roosevelt would be quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is the victim of conspiracy and injustice." Of course, the children would have problems reading these reports in the newspapers, since they're often kept illiterate and had no fingers for turning the pages. Also on this day, July 24th, 1925, John T. Scopes, convicted in Tennessee of teaching evolution in high school, fined $100 and costs for monkeying around. Also on this date in 1950, German V-2 became the first rocket to be launched at Cape Canaveral, Florida. Big surprise, as the U.S. provided safe haven for thousands of Nazis following World War II, including known war criminals and hundreds of scientists who developed the Nazi-German rocket program. In the U.S. intelligence, there is no prohibition for hiring anyone in the Gestapo or SS, historians said. This was a don't-ask-don't-tell culture. Also on this date in 1974, House Judicial Committee debates Nixon's articles of impeachment, including obstruction of justice, abuse of presidential powers, using CIA, FBI, and IRS and other federal agencies to violate civilian constitutional rights and to create the Plumbers Group to engage in illegal acts, as well as failure to supply subpoenaed material to the committee. Failure to turn over subpoenaed materials. Same crimes, different times. Lastly on this date in 1983, women tag U.S. warplanes with graffiti at Greenham Commons in England. This week in Radical History for July 25th, 1648 in New World, York County Court upholds authority of colonists to kill on site any free Indians they see in settled areas. Also on July 25th, 1930, a white mob threatens to hang ranchers employing Filipinos in Washington, Filipinos being the Mexican of their time, or the Irish before them, or the Polish before them, or the Chinese before them. Just pick your wave of immigrants you vilify and marginalize. Also 1946, the crime, 2 young black couples are killed by a lynch mob at Moore's Ford Bridge over the Apache River. The 4 were tied up and shot hundreds of times in broad daylight by unmasked men. Murder weapons included rifles, shotguns, pistols, and machine guns. The Tuskegee Institute newspaper called it a lynching. The cover-up. Despite the intense investigation by the FBI, the killers remain free. The best people in town won't talk, says Georgia State Patrol officer, on the climate of fear and threat of retaliation that discourages law-abiding citizens to cooperate with the investigation. Again, in 2005, there was another attempt to bring the survivors of the mob to justice, but that failed as well. No justice, no peace. Also on the state in 1969, proving how everyone is equal in the United States, Senator Edward M. Kennedy drives a car in which Mary Jo Capaci is killed earlier in the week, receives a 2-month suspended sentence for leaving the scene of an accident, however nothing for killing Mary Jo.
On this day, July 25th in 1972, the Washington Star exposed the story of the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, a cruel medical study that the U.S. Public Health Service had been conducting on 399 poor black men for the last 40 years. The men, who were in the late stages of syphilis and lacked access to proper health care, were not in a position to deny this supposedly free treatment. They were never told that they had syphilis and were actually left untreated while slowly dying from the degenerative disease. The experiment had continued despite the World Health Organization's 1964 declaration that informed consent was mandatory for experiments involving human beings.
Also on this date, 1983 in Nicaragua, the American right-wing funded Contras torture and kill 15 at San Francisco del Norte. Reagan compares the Contras to the nobility of Abraham Lincoln. Also on this date in 1990, U.S. Ambassador Applegate tells Iraq President Hussein that the U.S. won't take sides in Iraq-Kuwait dispute, or perhaps it will invade and start the first Gulf War. It's one or the other. Also on this date in 1993, Lebanon. Israeli begins blasting targets in southern Lebanon. 130 die by the end of the month. 500,000 civilians flee the bombardment. Tune in again in 2006 as Israel and Hezbollah go at it. Lastly on this date, in 2001, Bush administration, high on image, short on principle, rejects the draft treaty on enforcement of biologic weapons ban. Saddam can't have them, but we sure can.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Joy, I voted."
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to This Week in Palestine. We continue our coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference, which was held at the First Parish Church in Cambridge on November 11th of 2017. This morning we feature the second panel, which addressed Confronting the Balfour Consequences. The first speaker, Amal Bishara, addressed the consequences for Palestinians. The second speaker, Anat Beletsky, spoke to the consequences for Israel and the Jewish people. The third speaker is Rami Khoury, who spoke to the Balfour consequences for the Middle East. Here is panel two of the Balfour Legacy Conference.
Okay, first of all, I want to begin with a very big thank you to our organizers, especially Elaine Hagopian and Nancy Murray, and also to the entire Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, and to the entire community that comes together for occasions like this to learn and talk together. I'm really grateful to be a part of this excellent activist community. And that's, again, why I'm wearing this fabulous new T-shirt that y'all should pick up. As we know, this is a period of many anniversaries, 50 years of occupation last spring, next spring, 70 years of the Nakba. We tend to pay more attention to the anniversary of the Nakba than to Balfour. So why is it then today that it's especially useful for us to look back a bit further in history to consider the consequences of the Balfour Declaration 100 years on? I'm going to try to answer this question. And as I do that, first I'll start off with sort of the direct question that was posed to me about the consequences of Balfour for Palestinians. When I begin thinking about how to approach a question like this, the consequences of Balfour for Palestinians, I remembered a joke that a friend of mine in Ida refugee camp likes to tell. He looks and he says, "The first 100 years are difficult, but then it gets a little better." We see evidence for the first part, but not necessarily for the second at all yet. The first 100 years of Balfour have indeed been terrible for Palestinians. The Palestinian term of the ongoing Nakba, and Nakba al-Mustamirra, captures the extent of ongoing loss of land and rights, the basic ability to grow families and communities that Palestinians face in different ways, whether they are refugees outside of historic Palestine, living under military occupation, or inside Israel. We've seen the destruction of Palestinian industry, the deterioration of Palestinian environments, whether through the degradation of the coastal aquifer under Gaza or through colonial and neoliberal policies that put some of Israel's dirtiest industries and a huge amount of sewage and trash in the West Bank. Many refugees, we know, have faced rounds of war and dispossession that make any semblance of normality, normalcy, and health inconceivable, generations and generations on. Perhaps the biggest tour of Balfour has been fragmentation itself, the fragmentation of Palestinians into refugees outside of historic Palestine, Palestinians under military occupation, and Palestinian citizens of Israel. And, of course, these groups have been splintered even more than this, thinking again of the division, for example, of Palestinians in Jerusalem from Palestinians in the rest of the West Bank, and Palestinians in the West Bank from those in Gaza. All of these geographic divisions and differences in political status make it so difficult for Palestinians to do the things that other national groups do, to have a thriving public that revolves around a set of newspapers or television stations or comedy shows or whatever else, to debate so that they can debate and decide the ways in which we will memorialize our past and make decisions about how we want to raise the next generation. Palestinians cannot marry who they like. They cannot move to or within historic Palestine. We are in a constant struggle for and against papers, movement permits, identity cards, passports, travel documents. So in thinking about some of the causes of these issues, I think focusing on the Balfour Declaration allows us to highlight two insidious dynamics, colonialism and a racialized ethno-nationalism. And I know I'm on the right track because I'm kind of following on the themes that other previous speakers today have already, esteemed speakers have already begun to discuss. So the Balfour Declaration was a promise, as many Palestinian commentators have put it this week, from one who did not own Palestine to one who did not deserve it. By 1922, the British authorities had established what they declared was to be a temporary mandate, a form of colonial rule that purported to have the goal of developing people there, but which actually gave the British time to solidify their place in regional geopolitics. Mandate, in general, was not a path to independence, even outside the Palestinian context, but to a new kind of subordination. As international legal scholar Anthony Angi writes, quote, an examination of the mandate system illuminates the ways in which political sovereignty could be created to be completely consistent with economic subordination, end quote. In Palestine, the British mandate made it possible for the British to help put the Balfour Declaration into effect, since the Balfour Declaration was incorporated into the Palestine Mandate's preamble and second article, or I think it's the second article. So, of course, the essence of European colonialism is extraction and also rule by force, contradictorily legitimized by liberal political theorists and imperial civil servants who believed that some peoples were not ready for the rule of law. So it was that the mandate, especially its defense emergency regulations, would rule through repression. These emergency regulations allowed the trial of civilians by military tribunal without the right to appeal. They allowed punitive home demolitions, the administrative detention of people for an indefinite period, and the imposition of closed military zones. All of this should sound pretty familiar to those of us who've been following what's been going on under military occupation for 50 years. After the establishment of the State of Israel, the first Israeli cabinet absorbed those 1945 defense emergency regulations and other elements of British colonial law. Those regulations then became the basis for the Israeli military occupation of areas that Zionist armies conquered that were supposed to be Palestinian according to the UN partition plan. And this military rule lasted for 18 years and had dire consequences on Palestinians who lived under them. In addition to absorbing the British defense emergency regulations, the cabinet also declared a national state of emergency. It was the colonial logic of emergency that then allowed for the new Israeli state to depopulate lands of their Arab inhabitants. In 1967, these same British emergency laws became the basis for a new military occupation over the West Bank and Gaza. So administrative detention, home demolitions, and so forth have all continued. Even in its 1948 territories, Israel has never ended that state of emergency, though its use of this element of the non-legal system has fluctuated. This rule from outside the law was recently, for example, the basis for the declaration of the Islamic movement as illegal in Israel in 2015. And it's striking that even with all the laws that Israel has in place, anti-terror, anti-incitement laws, that they resorted to those British colonial laws because they could be even more repressive in outlawing a movement purely for political purposes. Of course, it's not only the text of its laws that we find the colonial logics of rule. Israel is a settler colonial state that continues to push Palestinians off their land. We see this especially in Israeli attempts to displace Bedouin, often multiple times, from the lands on which they live. I'm going to try to move through some of this. And we see this in the rhetorics with which they displace people. So in the case of the village of Umm al-Hayran, whose residents will be displaced from their village to make way for the Jewish town of Hayran, we see an Israeli co-optation of Palestinian presence through its naming practices, and at the same time, a racist determination that those Palestinians wouldn't be suitable to live in the new Jewish town of Hayran. So Balfour, in that sense, trains our attention to Zionism as a colonial project that built on previous British colonial projects. The second other key and other related legacy of the Balfour Declaration that I want to highlight today is that promotes an ethno-nationalist supremacist state in Palestine. Though Jews made up only a tiny percentage of the population at the time of the Balfour Declaration, of course, they were promised British support for the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Palestinians did not even warrant recognition in the document, and they were referred to instead as existing non-Jewish communities. And this exclusivist logic was recognized from the start, including by some Sephardic Jews, who noted that basically this kind of exclusivist logic was going to also dispossess them of their sort of relationship to the land in its own specific ways. Writing, for example, Haim Ben Kiki wrote, in the years after Balfour, the Sephardic community came from eastern lands to an eastern land, and our soul has been intertwined for generations with the Arab people. So the Balfour Declaration undermines some of that connection. The legacy of the erasure of Palestinian identity has continued under the Israeli state, which categorizes Palestinians in Israel as being Christians, Muslims, or Druze, as being non-Jews, sometimes Arabs, but never as Palestinians. Aside from issues of naming, the Israeli state has refused to recognize collective Palestinian rights, at times using the granting of individual civil liberties as a way to undermine collective identities. Thankfully, as Palestinian scholars like Nadim Rahana, Arij Sabalkhouri, and others have pointed out, in recent years, Palestinians have mobilized to reassert their collective rights within Israel. Still, though, Israel has a system of more than 50 laws that discriminate against Palestinians on a wide variety of topics. And we can see, again, sort of the entrenchment of this ethno-nationalist supremacist logic in Israel today in, for example, the Jewish Nation-State Bill, which is currently under consideration but has the strong support of Netanyahu, which would further solidify the state's Jewish characteristics at the expense of its democratic ones. For example, it would demote Arabic from being an official language of the state. Another bill under consideration with Netanyahu's support is the Muazzin Bill, which would categorize the Muslim call to prayer as unreasonable noise. Again, an attempt to erase Palestinian presence, unreasonable noise in particular for the dawn prayer. Of course, when a state promotes an atmosphere of ethnic or racial hierarchy, racist elements in society are only strengthened. We see that here today, unfortunately. So we see settler violence, including against Palestinian children in the West Bank. We see, mob violence on the rise in Jerusalem. And of course, Israel's military violence against Palestinians in Gaza and its ferocious siege and wars against Palestinians in Gaza is underwritten by racism, too, by that fundamental dismissal of the value of Palestinian lives. So I want to save a little time to talk about where do we go from here. One thing that Balfour does is it also pushes back our timeline for when Palestinians started their struggle against European colonialism. Palestinians have been resisting European-style settler colonialism for 100 years. In resisting the British mandate, Palestinians were an important part of a global movement against empire. I think, you know, our current crisis in Palestinian leadership should cause us to perhaps both think big and think small, to think creatively about what liberation would or should mean, perhaps beyond ideas of statehood. We can think alongside scholars of indigeneity and colonialism who remind us that the nation-state system is always inclined to reinforce the power of the powerful and to disempower smaller states whose sovereignty will always be compromised. So what can we do? We can work to forge connections with each other through the, and I'm thinking here of especially Palestinians and Palestinians in diaspora, but also Palestinians and their supporters, but Palestinians through the arts and new media technologies. Palestinians today are living vastly different lives from each other in a variety of political systems that are naturally difficult to understand from the outside. So we need to have difficult conversations about what divides us, but also about how to best take advantages of the positions we each hold. Can Palestinians build platforms outside of the restrictive and problematic dominant forms of social media like Facebook, which are inclined to surveillance, and so forth, to promote conversation about Palestinians' different lives and challenges? We see, for example, the digital rights organization Hamla, which is based in Haifa, doing important work to teach people about digital rights. That's a good start. Where else can we take that? Second, the Palestinian Authority, of course, is a corrupt and a minimalist model for sovereignty. But I think even in the best case, a Palestinian sovereignty would not be robust without thriving connections to a liberated Arab world, with connections forged not only on the basis of shared Arab and Muslim histories, but also on the basis of Middle Eastern diversities. So we should think about how to build those connections too. Third, many Palestinians, as well as Palestinian and Israeli anti-Zionist organizations, I'm thinking of Badil, Zohrot, are practicing return, even under the dire restrictions Palestinians face today. They're conducting village tours in places like Al-Qabu to keep Palestinian history alive and present in villages whose lands have been colonized. In the Galilee villages of Iqrit and Bera'am, from which many Palestinians were internally displaced, so they are displaced from the lands but living inside Israel, they can return to their villages in summer camps or to set up and maintain residency against military orders, and that is a powerful way of affirming Palestinian rights and presence. Fourth, Palestinians can work to restore their environments and keep Palestinian agriculture alive. And they're doing that in a variety of ways in a lot of different places. And I know you have a workshop later that can talk more about that, that I'm going to move through a little bit. Fifth, we need to work to advance the rights and enrich the life possibilities of women and sexual minorities who have been deeply impacted also by Israeli settler colonialism and violence. As scholars such as Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian and Sarah Ahmoud and others have analyzed, feminist perspectives can point the way for a real liberation for all of us. Honoring women's and men's stories of resistance and return and the significance of the Palestinian home is an important step on every step of this journey. Sixth, and finally for now, Palestinians need to find ways to build robust solidarity with others affected by settler colonialism, racism, militarism, and mass incarceration. Not only are we more powerful when we work together to make these connections, but we have much to learn from other movements, even though it's certainly true that the tactics of one site do not always translate to Palestine. These, of course, are just a few ideas to which we can all add as Palestinians and as allies. Just as the Nakba is ongoing, so is our struggle for liberation. Just as Patrick Wolf put it, settler colonialism is a structure and not an event, so will our liberation be a long process, and we must continue the work each day. Thank you all.
Thank you to Nancy. Thank you to Elaine. Thank you to all of you, and thank you especially for having me here. I'm an Israeli Jew. It's also hard to be number four or five. I love being the first speaker because the minute I am anything but the first speaker, I feel that I have to relate to and engage with and answer and ask more questions, especially, and this will come out, things that Susan said that are so relevant to what I want to say. So let me begin, and where I go off to just look at you, Susan, you'll understand what I'm doing. In his op-ed on October 28th this year, titled Balfour's Original Sin, Gideon Levy wrote, this is quoting him now, "There was never anything like it, an empire promising a land that it had not yet conquered to a people not living there without asking the inhabitants." And I said to myself, what else can I say if I'm supposed to talk about the consequences for Israel and the Jewish people? I think Gideon said it in one sentence. And then last week, there was an event at Harvard on November 5th and 6th, run by the Center for Jewish Studies at Harvard. It hosted about 20 people. I'm not being racist here, saying that I think 19 of them were Jewish. The name of the conference was the Balfour Declaration in Jewish History, and I thought to myself, oh, my God. The Balfour Declaration is now a point of Jewish history, and is that all we want to say? Can we really talk about the Balfour Declaration as a point of Jewish history, given everything that we have heard before, given everything that we know? So Gideon sort of evened out the Harvard conference, and I decided to think about the consequences for Israel and the Jews. These are interesting ways of putting it. Is it Israel or is it Zionism when we talk about the consequences, as we've heard before? Is it the Jews, the Jewish people, Judaism, Jewishness? What exactly are we talking about when we say consequences for the Jews, as it says in the title here? I will try to tell you about things that have happened in Israel and for the Jews that most of you obviously know about. But what I will try to do is talk about the common wisdom and the way people treat the Balfour Declaration, the cliches, the mantras, the way we in Israel or Jews in America have been brought up to think of the Balfour Declaration, how different that is from things that we know, even things that we've heard this morning. So in 1917, Balfour wrote those words, and I repeat them again, a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Every word there is important. A national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And he also wrote, and some say, in Israel, of course, that he had the decency to write, "I stand with those who decry the negatively nuanced edition here, quote, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine." So the common wisdom in Israel, and we hear this all the time, I think we hear it also in most Jewish communities all over the world, is that the Balfour Declaration legitimized or endorsed, those are the words that we hear, legitimized or endorsed the idea of a nation state for the Jewish people. And what does that mean? That constitutes sovereignty, land, and military. I always think of the fact, and I'm thinking here of Danny Boyarin, who says the whole point of Jewish culture in Europe was that we didn't have sovereignty, land, or military. That's what made Jewishness so great. You didn't need sovereignty or land or a military to have a great Jewish culture, and that again corresponds with what we were talking about culture before. So I wonder, how is it that that has become such common wisdom, that Balfour endorsed or legitimized, as if there was an idea already and he was the one endorsing it, he was legitimizing that idea? And yes, that idea was surfacing, definitely since Zionism came out explicitly, but still, how could that be so different from the legal concepts that we know? How could it be so different from both international and domestic law in so many places? How could it be so different even from historical fact? When we do political science, I think we spend much more time than we had this morning about the concept of a nation. When I teach human rights law, I always think about that right to a nationality, and I always wonder, why did they say nationality rather than citizenship? So we heard from Susan how these things are so clearly defined and determined in law, but they are not in the way that people speak in ordinary language. The concept of nation, the concept of people, are the two concepts that Zionism and the Jews in Israel, not so much outside of Israel, but in Israel, nation and people are the two concepts that trouble anyone who thinks there is moral or political trouble here. There's also state, religion, and race, and I'll bring that up in a minute, but nation and people. Balfour said, national home for the Jewish people. There's nation in there and there's people in there. And that is what created, more than endorsed and more than legitimized, that feeling of surety, of certainty, that we are a nation and a people. We had that, I have the Hebrew word, gushpanka, but that is the approval, the final approval for that type of entity for the Jews, being not just a culture, a religion, but actually a people and a nation, and getting that approval from the empire, of course. I'm going to rush over. I'm not going to talk about what Zionism in general said about those things, but I think it's been mentioned here without the name yet, Brit Shalom, which was one branch of Zionism. They thought of themselves as Zionists. That's Buber, etc., that whole famous list of people. They thought they were Zionists, but they didn't think that had anything to do with a sovereign state. They thought they were even willing to go with nation and people. But it was a cultural aspect rather than any kind of legal or political thing. And that's how we bring them up now every time we talk about the one-state solution. So I'll talk about that later, perhaps, if we have time. It's by looking at the protesters against the Balfour Declaration that I can now pinpoint the consequences for Israel and the Jews. There's an amazing text from 1919 that was written by, I think, 28 or 30 American Jews. Famous names there. Some diplomats, Morgenthau, who was father of R. Morgenthau, I think, of the political science guy. He had been ambassador to Turkey, if I'm not mistaken. 1919, they wrote a letter to Wilson just before he went to the peace conference, post-World War I peace conference. And they said they want to explain to him why the idea of a Jewish state is misguided and worse. These were American Jews writing Wilson why there shouldn't be a Jewish state. Now note, they say, quote, at the outset we wish to indicate our entire sympathy with the efforts of Zionists which aim to secure for Jews at present living in lands of oppression a refuge in Palestine or elsewhere where they may freely develop their capabilities and carry on their activities as free citizens. So that kind of Zionism was okay, to have a refuge in Palestine or elsewhere for Jews suffering from oppression. But then they explicitly go on to tell us that that has nothing to do with a Jewish state. Regarding Israel, and they're going to say one thing about Israel, two things actually about Israel, and one thing about the Jews, and that is absolutely fascinating. 1919, regarding Israel, quote, whether the Jews be regarded as a race or as a religion, it is contrary to democratic principles for which the World War was waged to found a nation on either or both of these bases. A Jewish state involves fundamental limitations as to race and religion, else the term Jewish means nothing. And they go on to say, to unite church and state in any form would be a leap backward of 2,000 years. That's about Israel. About the Jews, they say, quote, the Balfour Declaration to establish a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine means a home for Jews universally. No Jew, wherever he may live, can consider himself free from the implications of such a grant. We object because the Jews are dedicated heart and soul to the welfare of the countries in which they dwell under free conditions. All Jews repudiate every suspicion of a double allegiance. But to our minds, it is necessarily implied in and cannot by any logic be eliminated from the establishment of a sovereign state for the Jews in Palestine. So there you have it all. There you have what happened to Israel and what happened to the Jews, where in 1919 some wise Jews saw that this would happen. This is exactly the consequences of the Balfour Declaration. For Israel, the Balfour Declaration meant two horrific conclusions. The Jewish state could not be democratic because of its Jewish exclusivity, and the Jewish state, based on its religious identification, not to mention its justification, of course, by religious texts and promises, could not abide by the democratic principle of separation and religion of state. So there's two things here. There's the discrimination, and there's the church and state. Discrimination according to church, synagogue, and then melding those together. For Jews everywhere, the Jewish state could not but create a double loyalty and a confusion of identities, especially for people who were dedicated to social justice. There was an amazing publication here in America that started in 1948, edited by William Zuckerman, spelled just with a K, not C-K, Zuckerman. It was called The Jewish Newsletter. He died in 1961, and then it went out of print completely. It was an anti-Zionist Jewish publication. Beautiful. If you open up the book today of those articles, it sounds exactly like the conversations we're having right now. All right. So these were Jewish anti-Zionists. They were in a minority, as were the people who wrote Wilson. They wrote Wilson that letter. Wilson doesn't even refer to it. We have the letter. We don't have anything by Wilson. All right, so Balfour didn't legitimize the idea of a nation state. He literally articulated it and did so formally with the blessing of the empire. And thus he is considered, and rightly so by Israelis, the father of an international recognition of Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel. And now we want to take one further step. So we've got Israel not being democratic. We've got American Jews being conflicted. And a further step, and that is, of course, colonialism. Interestingly, the opposition to the declaration, which mentioned colonialism, came from different but very understandable quarters. While the American Jews saw the problem of the Jewish state as thwarting democracy, it was a few Mizrahi Jews in Palestine, and we've mentioned this here as well, seeing the asymmetry that's articulated in the declaration between Jews and Palestinians. But they were the ones who were opposing it, and they were the ones who brought up colonialism. Just recently, unearthed a few papers written by Mizrahi Jews again in the 20s, 1921, 1924. The two names that come to mind are Yosef Kastel and Chaim Ben Kiki. Very interesting. I mean, they do come up in Israeli history here and there and other things. But they, again, spoke out against the Balfour Declaration. Think of this. This was already almost 5 years after the Balfour Declaration, but they're dealing with it. Kastel says, and this is interesting, they mention two different things, but they both come from the same root. Kastel says that we need to develop the other inhabitants, and the other inhabitants are the Palestinian, what he is calling Arabs, the other inhabitants' current national home. So he's taking that concept, national home, and he's saying they have a national home as well and uphold their legal rights over the land. So they're seeing this already then as a legal thing. In other words, unlike the Zionists, he thought Arabs had national rights to the land and looked at the practical feasibility of living together on the same land. Ben Kiki, who is speaking explicitly from the Mizrahi perspective, viewed the Balfour Declaration as a colonialist project. And he uses those words. He viewed the Balfour Declaration as a colonialist project that undermines, with its European interests and culture, the cooperation and mutual cultural intertwining between Mizrahi Jews and Palestinians. And you read it again today. It sounds like I would have him give a course, excuse me, in anthropology on post-colonialism, because he's talking about the place where Mizrahi Jews and Palestinians have so much together because of their North African and Middle Eastern roots. This is colonialism voiced, or anti-colonialism voiced in the words of the local who's coming out against Ashkenazi European colonialism. All right. So, three things then. Israel is not going to be democratic for two reasons: discrimination in church and state. Jews are going to be conflicted. And worst of all, Israel is going to be a colonialist state. Not very many people spoke that way then. I think we all know that now. So as Gidon says, not only did Balfour establish the idea of a Jewish national state, he also bequeathed us the idea of a colonial state. This is because Balfour did not say two states. He said one Jewish state with civil and religious rights for the others. Concrete consequences rather than ideological ones. Well, every town in Israel has a street named Balfour. The prime minister's home is on Balfour Street. And we always think of that, or probably we don't always think of that. High schools are called Balfour. We teach Balfour. I've had a lot of conversations this past week with Israelis. Most of them tell me that they never taught us much about the Balfour Declaration. I do remember 1897, beginning of Zionism, 1917, Balfour, 1947, Kaftet B'November is the UN partition plan. Those are the three pre-state dates that you do learn. So I am thinking about Balfour as a historical effect that has had such deep consequences. He is always celebrated. That conference in Harvard was a celebration. There was a tiny bit of internal criticism from the Mizrahi side, but it was a celebration. For Israelis, it's a celebration. It's a celebration that we are not democratic. It's a celebration that we have the Jews with us, whether conflicted or not, and it's a celebration that we are such successful colonialists. I can only end by saying there's not one song about Balfour. Thank you.
Thank you very much to all the organizers and sponsors and volunteers who put this together, and all of you who've attended. It's an honor and a great pleasure for me to be here and share some thoughts with you. But mostly it's inspiring to see the continued dynamism of people of justice and ethics and fairness in the United States from all quarters of life to get together and to continue this struggle, which has been going on for many years. And appropriately, the Balfour Declaration is a mechanism that we can use to analyze all of the dimensions of this conflict. And you know, some people accuse us of going back to the past, and they say, why do you keep thinking of the past? Why don't you just look to the future? And the answer to that is because the past hasn't ended. The past is still dynamic. The dynamics of the past are still governing our lives and plaguing many aspects of our lives. And I'll give you just one fascinating little personal anecdote. When my first son was born on July 24, 1980, when my father came to the hospital — we're Palestinians from Nazareth — and when my father came to the hospital, he said, Maysalun Day. I said, what the hell's Maysalun Day? He said, your son was born on Maysalun Day. And I asked him to explain that to me. I'm not a student of history. And he said Maysalun Day was, of course, a historic battle west of Damascus on July 24, 1920, when a group of Syrian nationalists went out to confront the French army that was coming in. And, of course, they were badly defeated because of the power of the French, and they lost, and the French went in to take Damascus, overthrew the budding young Arab-Syrian kingdom, it was called then. And then history played itself out. But the anecdote is important because it tells us that these episodes resonate in people's lives. My father was not born in 1920. He was born in the 1930s. But these things are living memories from historical markers that still shape our lives and, in many cases, plague our lives. And the Balfour Declaration, in its core elements, for me, captures all of the negative dynamics and values that pertained back to there in 1917, back then, but still pertain today. And these are essential. I'm not going to go over them because you've heard them in other things, but it's the basic idea that foreign powers, imperial or colonial or just strong, active, dynamic foreign powers, can intervene in our region, do what they want, manipulate our land, our people, our identities, the names of our countries, the borders. They can do anything they want, that we don't matter. The indigenous people don't matter. We have no rights. We have no voice. We have no claims to anything in the face of this imperial power. We're invisible people, and we don't exist. And the foreign powers can do anything they want in our land to serve their interests, or the interests of people that they want to help, in this case the Jewish people or the Zionists, who they wanted to help but who also they exploited for various reasons. So for their purposes, for the Western imperial purposes, that fundamental dynamic that we don't count, foreign power dominates everything and does whatever it wants in our region, is still the defining dynamic of political actions by Zionism and the Israeli state and by foreign powers as well. So when we see Nikki Haley say that she will never allow a Palestinian to have a senior post at the United Nations, this is quite extraordinary, but it's not new. This is the living reconfiguration of the dynamics of Balfour. When the U.S. announces it's going to leave UNESCO, this is the living reaffirmation of the Balfour Declaration dynamics in action, and it goes on and on and on. So these things are important to keep in mind, and the points that I want to make quickly in my comments are about how the Balfour Declaration has impacted the Arab world, and it has impacted the Arab world and beyond the Arab world in the Middle East. When you look at Turkey and Iran and other places, it has impacted the Middle East in many ways, most of them negative, virtually all of them negative, and it still continues to impact much of our region and our people in negative ways. And historically, going through them, I would say the earliest negative impact that permeates the Arab world and still plagues us today is the way that the Balfour Declaration, the birth of Zionism, the creation of the State of Israel, which is really one dynamic. You can't separate them. So when I say Balfour Declaration, I'm talking about Zionism, I'm talking about the creation and expansion of the State of Israel and its consolidation. The single biggest impact, I believe, historically in the Arab world of the Balfour Declaration has been to elicit from within the Arab world a tradition that has been the single most destructive force in our lives in the Arab region and continues until this day. And the Israelis are still active in this. And this single most destructive force is the tradition of military men taking power in Arab countries. It started in the 40s, a little bit in the 30s in Iraq, and in the 40s a little bit in Syria, but it was really 1952 when Nasser in Egypt, and then it spread to other countries, where military men took power by force, executive power, and then they controlled the judiciary, the legislatures, the army, the economy, and the information systems. They controlled all power in Arab countries totally. And they ran these Arab countries into the ground over the next 50 years. And you see it, you see the consequences today, these wrecks of countries, these fragmented countries, these shattered countries, these countries at war with themselves, these countries that generate savagery in the form of terrorist movements and radical movements that chop people's heads off, and massive refugee flows, displaced people, entire cities displaced. This is the legacy of Arab military rule nonstop since the early 1950s, and it spread after that, of course, to Libya with Gaddafi, to Iraq with Saddam Hussein, to Syria with the Assads, who are still there, to Zain al-Abidin bin Ali, Ali Abdullah Saleh, Omar Hassan al-Bashir. You rattle these names off like a string of rogues, a rogues gallery of Arab military leaders who had total power and who were totally incompetent in managing their countries. And that legacy is still active today. You see it in Egypt. And the latest manifestation of this, and this is where, again, we see the reincarnation of the fundamental dynamics of Balfourism, which is in Saudi Arabia now. The Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, in the last 2 weeks, basically, has brought into his hands military power, economic power, political power, religious power, cultural power, and media power. We now have one man in Saudi Arabia. He happens to be a very dynamic and very young and totally inexperienced young man, which is typical in the Arab tradition, unfortunately. But this man now has almost total power to do anything he wants. And if history is any kind of guide, he's going to drive Saudi Arabia into the ground or create tensions. We'll see. I hope he doesn't. I hope that he does well and people help him and he sees the light and he turns out to be a great national leader. But I kind of doubt it, because as we see in all these other cases where power was concentrated in the hands of individual people in Arab countries, we've had train wrecks and massive catastrophes and massive human displacement and suffering, dealing in the hundreds of millions of people across our region. And we can trace this tradition back to the impact of Balfour and Zionism in the 1940s to Arab officers who felt that they had to take control because only they could protect our countries from the threat of Zionism. That was the excuse they used, but they proved totally incompetent at both pushing back against Zionism or developing the potential of our Arab countries. This led to decades and decades, 50, 60, 70 years of incredible waste of money and human resources and time, and we see it again all around the region today. The continuous cumulative inability of the Arabs to meet the Israelis head-on militarily. In 1948 and 56, 67, 73, in other wars, this created another negative impact across the region, which was the growing sense among many, many people in the Arab world, not all of them, but I would say clearly a majority, who had lost confidence in both the efficacy and the legitimacy of their own governments. And this was an important element that fed into the uprisings in 2010, 2011. It wasn't the main element, but it was there in the foundation of the sense among millions and millions of Arab citizens that their governments were not serving them, that their governments were tormenting them and humiliating them. And what people were asking for when they rose up was the antidote to humiliation, which was dignity and the social justice. And part of the reason for this is the sense that these governments were totally incompetent and unjust in dealing with their people and unable to do anything about the threat of Israel. Also, this situation of Balfour and Zionism and Israel created a situation which we also see today, and again, Mohammed bin Salman and others in the Gulf, where Arab elites and Arab citizens at the community level became separated, where elites went for certain national goals, usually pandering to the desires and interests of Western imperial powers, in some cases Eastern powers, maybe Iran, maybe Russia, maybe Turkey, maybe China soon, but pandering to foreign powers as interests more than the rights of their own people. So the split between the populations in the Arab countries and the elites started way back then, and we've seen this recurring over the years, where Arab governments would do what they thought the Americans and the Israelis or the British would like, and they did that, and it created more and more tension in Arab countries. And we see it today with the Saudis and others in the Gulf thinking about how can we have normal relations with Israel without really solving the problem of Palestine equitably for Israelis and Palestinians. We must repeat continuously that we're prepared for a noble, honest, just peace that gives Israelis and Palestinians their national rights, security, recognition, and human dignity. We're not talking anymore, as people did in the 50s, about throwing Israel into the sea, which was only used once or twice. But the point is, we acknowledge the legitimacy of a Jewish-majority Israeli state. We didn't before, but we do now. It's official Arab policy. But Arab leaders are still looking to the power of Israel, the power of the United States and others to protect them from the troubles that they have at home or in the region. In some cases, they have trouble. Arabs have trouble, say, with Iran, and they think that the West can protect them. They have trouble with dynamic Islamist activists or others. But again, we can trace that split of elites and people back to the impact of Balfour and the creation of the State of Israel. Another thing that the Balfour Israel legacy created were these militant Islamist movements. Groups like Hamas and Hezbollah that came into being in the early 1980s, essentially. They didn't exist before. We had mild Islamists, we had Muslim Brothers, we had mainstream nonviolent Islamist groups, which were perfectly legitimate and exist in all societies. But we didn't have militant resistance groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. And these have become now major players in the region. They have created major new tensions with Israel and with the West and with Arab countries, to the point now where the Saudi-Emirati blockade of Qatar, one of the things they're demanding is to cut ties with Hamas and Islamist movements like that. And the recent Lebanese-Saudi tensions of the last week are focused very much on Hezbollah. Linked to that is the other problem that the Zionism has created recently, which is tensions beyond the Arab world with Iran and with Turkey, which have over the years had cold and hot relations with Israel. Back in the days of the Shah, the Israelis and the Iranians were very close, sharing security and oil and all kinds of other things. Then it changed after the revolution. And in the Turkish case, again, Turkey had bad relations, good relations, then bad relations, then good relations, and now they're somewhere in between. So the rippling consequences of the Balfour Declaration, the State of Israel, and the impact on the region, the Arab world, and beyond, continue to be manifested in so many different ways, politically, strategically, and militarily. Another impact of the Balfour Declaration was to validate the idea of an ethnic state, which Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and the Islamic State thought was a great idea, and then so we've had the Islamic State announced, and then it was pushed back, and now we'll see what happens next. But to validate the idea of a small ethnic state is something relatively new in the region, because most of the states of the region and the societies of the region were very multinational and pluralistic. Another problem that we have is the humiliation continuing until this day, we still see it, of Arab countries that are trying to buy technology or military equipment from Western sources, especially the United States or England, and they can't buy it unless the Israelis give their approval. so that Arab well-being, as defined by the Arab countries, whatever it is, they want to buy a computer system or an F-35 jet or whatever it is, the Israelis have to say okay. And if the Israelis say no, we can't have it. So again, this is incredibly humiliating and leads to continued erosion in the sense of ordinary Arab citizens that their governments are actually legitimate governments that are looking out for their best interests, and they sense that their governments are basically doing whatever they're allowed to do by the Israelis and the United States. So those are some of the main points that really I would point out are the ways that Balfour and Zionism and Israel have rippled across the Arab world. And the most important point, finally, in the end, is that these problems continue, that the Balfour principles and the policies of Zionism and the practices of the State of Israel are very much continuing in colonization, in expulsions, in mass incarcerations, in assassinations, in denials of rights, and they've now reached your country here in the United States, where they're trying to pass legislation which prevents criticizing Israel, which you will hear about in the afternoon. Thank you very much.
Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Robert Hansen talks about the Hong Kong National Party and why it looks as if, just as it's begun, it's about to be banned. And if Americans knew... Alison Weir explains the long relationship between the US and Israel. She's an author of the book Against Our Better Judgment. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Robert Hansen. I live in Hong Kong. I've been living here, getting on for 10 years. Background in England was barrister. In Hong Kong, I ran a firm that sort of helps barristers from London gain access to the Hong Kong market.
So, is the legal system the same? Obviously, it's a former colony. What's the difference between UK and the Hong Kong legal system?
They are virtually the same. There are minor differences, but they are pretty much...
And how about Hong Kong and China? Are they similar?
They're different. You see, China has a civil law system and Hong Kong has a common law system. Common law system is just like the UK system, which is judge-made law. So it's a mixture of statutes, stuff that you pass in Parliament, and you can refer to judicial decisions, and that's how Hong Kong works. Under a civil law system, which the European Union has and China has, it's all statute-based as opposed to judge-based law.
So you can't refer back and say, hang on a minute, this judgment went this way, and that be used in court afterwards?
It's not really. I mean, you would just really refer to the statute all the time. And the statute, the law is supposed to cover every single situation, so there is no flexibility.
Well, that sounds almost impossible.
It is. I mean, this is why the European Union is probably in quite a bit of a mess as well with its legal system. And that's why you have pages and pages of laws that are very difficult to cover.
Anyway, Robert, can you just bring us up to date with what's happening with Hong Kong? Because I think it was 1998. Apparently, Hong Kong was handed over to China, only it wasn't quite. There was going to be another 50 years. So by my calculations, that's 2048. Was going to be no, apparently, and I don't know if this is true or not, you better inform us, no interference in Hong Kong affairs by China up until 2048, and then the Chinese would really start taking over. So you're on this path. I just wonder, you know, if you could just explain to us what that means and how accurate my assessment there was for Hong Kong people.
It's fairly accurate. Just one point, it was 1997 that the 1st of July was the handover, and the last governor was Chris Patten. And at that point in Hong Kong, there was no democracy at all in Hong Kong. It was a colony and you had a governor, so there was no democracy. And the person that actually wanted democracy in Hong Kong was Chris Patten. Many people, particularly perhaps the Communist Party, were suspicious about this because they viewed it, this democratic movement, as a way of unseating the Communist Party. But since 1997, for the next 50 years, Hong Kong will retain its status as a capitalist economy. So it won't be a communist economy, it will be a capitalist economy under the principle of one country, two systems.
Okay, and what does that mean in regards to things like police, armed forces, that kind of thing?
What it means is that when it comes to national security, it's one country. When it comes to trade, local legislation, the way things are done, the culture of Hong Kong, that's two systems, which means Hong Kong has its own legal system, its own way of doing business, which is different than China. But when it comes to national security, China is saying, no way, Jose, are you ever going to separate from
Okay, so China. Does that mean you've got Chinese troops running around in Hong Kong?
We don't see them, but there are Chinese garrisons in Hong Kong.
Do they come out or much? Or I wonder what it's like. Chinese ships, that sort of thing, naval ships?
Naval ships patrol the South China Sea, and there are helicopters flying over occasionally, but it's not immediate and it's not apparent. For example, in 2014, we had the Occupy Central movement, and that was when students and many people occupied all the streets from Central to Admiralty. That's a good half a mile. A lot of real estate, many, many people just took over all the main roads, all the dual carriageways, put tents on the roads, and they occupied that for approximately 3 months, from September to December. And that was dispersed by the police and by the Hong Kong judiciary, and the Chinese army not involved at all. It was probably one of the most peaceful protests ever. I walked there quite a few times. It was amazing to be able to walk from Central to Admiralty. It's about a 10-minute walk maximum. And all that you saw was students in tents, and they were doing homework. I mean, we are talking so incredibly well-behaved. Students at night literally doing homework, studying, a few people singing songs around a guitar. There was absolutely no trouble whatsoever.
Fascinating. Look, what was the reason for that then, particularly?
The reason for the protest was that Hong Kong wanted to have something called universal suffrage within this sort of 50-year period. And they were promised it for the at different times, and it didn't happen in the last round of elections. And so they said, delay's too much. We're going to protest because we want to have this thing called universal suffrage. Because at the moment, the chief executive of Hong Kong, it's currently somebody called Carrie Lam, she's only elected by a very small number of people. For example, I can't vote. Most people can't vote. You either have to be, in order to vote, an elected member of parliament or representing a particular trade organization. So ordinary people can't vote for the chief executive, but they can vote for members of parliament. So in a sense, we do have a certain amount of democracy in terms of you can elect members of parliament and local councillors, but you just can't directly vote for the chief executive.
Now, I know in your parliament, you've got a limited amount of democracy. You've got a kind of pro-establishment parties, and you've got pro-democracy parties, middle class, yes, and upper class. But we've recently seen a splitting away of something new called the Hong Kong National Party, and the authorities are not happy, are they? What's going on with them? Why has the Hong Kong National Party decided it wants to split or form? And why is the government there saying it shouldn't be able to? Where are we at with this?
Okay. The Hong Kong National Party essentially wants Hong Kong to be separate from mainland China. And this goes against what is the basic law, which upon handover stated that Hong Kong would always remain part of China. But a lot of the younger students are annoyed with the way Hong Kong's been run, annoyed that they haven't got universal suffrage so they can vote for the chief executive, and said, hey, the only way forward is to separate Hong Kong from mainland China.
Well, it sounds to me like a bit of a ticking time bomb, possibly. I know one of the reasons for this is this social credit system that the Chinese have just introduced. Can you tell us about that? Because this is, I think, one of the things which is really scaring people in Hong Kong, saying, well, OK, China's taking us over, but we don't want to have a seriously authoritarian system, and this does have the hallmarks of that.
A social credit system is, if you do minor things wrong, you get points. But like in a car, if you do minor driving offences, you might get 3 points, 4 points, or 5 points. And when you get to a certain level of points, you get banned from doing certain activities. So if, for example, you cross the road at a point where you have one of those green men crossings, pelican crossings, and it's on red, and you cross on red, you'll get a few negative points. And if you do that enough times, you'll get suspended from travelling for a certain period of time. So it's bad social behaviour.
So does that mean people wouldn't be able to go to work, for example?
They'd be able to travel locally. They wouldn't be able to sort of travel, say, between different Chinese states. And I suppose ultimately, if they're banned from travelling, yeah, they would have to walk to work or
cycle.
Life gets very difficult. It's,
well, can they cycle?
Yeah. Can they cycle? Gosh.
Yes, that's a difficult one, isn't it? But I mean,
that's a difficult one for me, because the way travel's going, more people having these electronic travel, like an octopus. I think you have them in England. They're not called
the Oyster cards they have in London. They've got the octopus in Hong Kong, haven't they? The public transport is incredibly efficient in Hong Kong. It's very fast. It's very cheap. And even the ferries, you know, fantastic. But so you would be potentially denied that in the long term in Hong Kong, although they're starting to do that in China now. So can you get positive points, or is this just, you know, the system sounds very strange? You know, like if you say something nice about the government, you might get positive points. And if you say something bad about them, you get negative points. Now, this is starting to be almost a sort of form of government imposed apartheid.
If you do good things for the government, you get rewards, but it's not obvious rewards. If you, say nice things about the party or help the party in some way, you'll receive subtle forms of help. You get to meet important people, develop important business contacts, and it's up to you what you do with them.
I mean, that seems to be the way the establishment works all over the world, though.
It is. I mean, I will give you a couple of quotes from the South China Morning Post, because I one of the old-fashioned people actually cuts out clippings from newspapers. And this is kind of rare because it doesn't happen. That's why I kept these two. And this is from 17th of September 2015. And it's about Lee Ka-sing, one of Asia's richest people, I think the 23rd richest man in the world. And the South China Morning Post makes this point. It said, Lee enjoyed a great run in mainland markets in the past decades, largely because Beijing gave him preferential treatment. And then a few days later, on the 20th of September, they also wrote, this is the Beijing government, said that Lee had not grown rich from a level playing field in a market economy, but owed his success to his connections with top officials who gave him access to prime locations, often at hugely discounted prices. So that's how it works. I suppose this is what you call the positive credit.
Just characterise for us, if you can, this new Hong Kong National Party, and what's the debate like in Hong Kong about whether it's going to be allowed to continue or whether it's going to be banned?
It's got 21 days, I think, from yesterday to oppose a potential banning. In Hong Kong, just to briefly cap the law, there's something called Article 23, which is part of the Hong Kong Basic Law, and it was accepted at the point of handover and will remain in force for 50 years. Article 23 has not been enacted yet, but that's the key piece of legislation that bans sedition, i.e. the separation of Hong Kong from mainland China. But because it's not been in force, what the government is using, it's using an ordinance, a different ordinance, to ban this party and to stop the party, just under more general laws. That's how it's working.
So the thing is, I mean, for example, in the future, if, say, a vast majority of people from Hong Kong decided they actually didn't want and didn't like being part of China and wanted to leave, a little bit like, say, for example, we had the vote in Scotland to leave the United Kingdom, or in Catalonia to leave Spain, then that simply would be considered a seditious act, and people who were trying to organise such a referendum would be criminalised.
They would be criminalised and put in prison, yeah. If anyone goes anywhere near separation, that's the red line. That's absolutely, definitely a non-starter.
I mean, what do people like yourself, I mean, you're UK born, but people who are Anglophiles make of the slow road towards China taking over Hong Kong then?
I think quite a lot of people want to get wealth, their personal wealth, out of Hong Kong. And actually quite a lot of wealthy people want to get their wealth out of China as well. That takes me on to another very interesting, slight topic. And that is, in the Hong Kong press, there's always property, overseas property advertised. It used to be mainly London, still is, but also places like Birmingham and Manchester. And I was reading in the weekend Financial Times that Birmingham and Manchester have experienced the highest house price increases in the UK by quite a substantial margin. And a lot of that demand has come from places like Hong Kong and China, where the property is being sold as investment property. So there's people wanting to move money out of Hong Kong and China into places they perceive.
I mean, Robert, do people that you know, are they making plans to leave or not?
A lot of people have dual passports. So if things got bad, you could just leave at any time. So are they planning to leave? A few people have left that I've known, yes. But other people are just quite happy and just carrying on as normal. But if you've got a dual passport, whether it be a Canadian passport or a British passport or a New Zealand passport, you don't have to worry too much, because if it does get bad, you can just leave.
What about the growth of technology? I know that you were concerned about that just recently with the imposition of a rollout of 5G and smart meters. We've seen a similar sort of thing going on here in the UK, but what's happening in Hong Kong?
Hong Kong, nothing seemed to be happening until quite recently, and then I was absolutely horrified to read that in the newspaper now, smart meters are going to be in every apartment within 5 years' time.
And well, that's what they said here. It isn't happening.
Back to the quotes I read out about this Lee Ka Sing. He owns, essentially, the Hong Kong Telecom, well, his company does, and he owns a lot of the management companies that manage property, and he builds most of the Hong Kong properties. So back to the point I was making about positive credits. If, as these articles suggest, he owes the mainland and the Hong Kong government favours, and they say to him, hey, Mr. Lee, make sure you have 5G, make sure these smart meters are installed, they will be installed. Have no doubts about that.
And what are your concerns about those technologies?
My concerns about it are because I have problems with certain like LED lights and CFL lights. I don't like the radiation from those. If I use a mobile phone, my head gets warm, so I don't like mobile phones. And the idea of having similar radiation or more powerful radiation close by, I just don't want it. That's because I think it will have a negative impact on my health. And I'm also concerned that the media is just not covering any downsides to 5G and smart cities. The media is almost acting like sales agents for the government on this issue.
I mean, isn't this a technology which is in a way inevitable, that that you're going to have this Internet of Things where everything is interconnected to everything else via data, mobile data networks, and via Wi-Fi?
People have survived a long time without it, and things seem to work pretty well without it. And I actually find the more mobile technology people have, it just tends to create more problems. If I wanted to go out with friends a long time before mobile phones came along, we'd just say, see you next Thursday, and everybody would be there next Thursday. Now you've got this thing called a mobile phone. People text, hey, can we make it a different day? Hey, can we make it a bit later? Hey, how about changing the place? And it seems to be more, less helpful than ever before. I don't find it useful at a personal level. And a bigger fear is that once all data is concentrated in one place, just think 1984, Winston Smith, you can rewrite history. You can create whatever you want. You can create whatever truth you want that's going to be on your mobile phone and on your computer, because whoever controls that computer and the mobile phone controls what you read. And what you read is the truth as the controller of that data wants you to see it.
Yeah,
I think that's a big problem.
It is, isn't it? I mean, especially with the consolidation of the press into fewer and fewer hands all the time. Also, what about electronic cash? I know there's a bit of a push for it in the UK. We've slowly but surely things have changed, haven't they, from signing credit card chitties to chip and pin to signing for your by your credit card to chip and pin, now to these kind of contactless cards, which everyone has just been given. I mean, the whole technology has been changed. Nobody really has been asked. But what's happening with electronic cash in Hong Kong?
Hong Kong is traditionally a very cash place. People work, have cash, like to buy things in cash, like to trade in cash. But what's happening, again, because back to the Lee Ka Sing factor, he also owns a lot of supermarkets in Hong Kong. There's probably about three families that control all the major supermarkets in Hong Kong. And all these supermarkets now are saying, if you spend the equivalent of £50 and you use your credit card, you will get £5 back. But if you use a smartphone, you'll get £8 knocked off your bill. So there's a massive incentive to try to get people to use electronic payments.
They're doing a similar thing here in Bristol with the buses, where if you pre-buy your tickets or if you use some app on the phone which steals all your data for first group who run the buses, and then you're getting a cheaper bus ticket than if you use cash. I mean, this surely, though, is just because there are costs involved to all businesses in handling cash, whereas electronic money is much easier for them to handle.
When I was younger, if you used to go to somewhere and say, hey, any discount for cash, and these are established organisations, they'd say, yeah, sure, you get a discount for cash because people wanted cash.
Well, that was because it didn't go through the books often. It was just, it didn't actually go and get taxed, for example.
I think not always. I mean, some places would do, because if you use a credit card, the credit card company would charge a percentage for collecting that money from the retailer or the seller. And therefore, if you gave him cash, he didn't have to pay that percentage, I think was part of the deal. But also with electronic payments, where if you use an electronic payment and you park your car in a car park, and you can say you've paid so much money in a supermarket or anywhere in that shopping mall, you'll get 3 hours free parking. But if you pay by cash, you have to pay $60 or £6 to park your car for 3 hours. So the incentive game is on in town. And my guess would be that once you've got rid of the cash, the incentive will no longer apply.
You're probably right. I mean, isn't there a bigger agenda, do you think, with electronic cash?
Oh, the electronic cash game, talk about all day about this one. The electronic cash game is about monitoring exactly what people do, what they spend, and you've got total control over them. Also, if you no longer have cash and you really annoy the system, they can stop you buying things. They can stop you. They can say, sorry, you've got so many points now on your negative credit. You've crossed too many roads and it's been a red man at the Pelican Crossing. Sorry, you can only spend so much now on food, or you can only... It gives people more control over you. This is also... The electronic cash is also done through fear factor. Another big topic is international law. And when you have international laws, if you have international law, those laws control a country from outside the country. And more now we've got anti-money laundering legislation. It's actually called anti-money laundering and terrorism legislation. The fear put into people being terrorism, that moving money around causes problems. Therefore, they have to monitor more detail about your bank accounts and everything that you go and do. And if it's a large amount of money, it's flagged up as a suspicious transaction, and people can then close your account, start investigating your account, and make your life very difficult.
I mean, this sounds to me like a sort of Big Brother society being created. I'm sure it's not just in Hong Kong, across much of the Western world. How's China getting on with all of this? I mean, are they cash friendly, or are they also on a push to electronic money? Because I know in India, for example, they had a massive push for electronic money, and they're trying to literally ban cash. In fact, they took loads of the hard denomination notes out of circulation in India. So what's the situation in China?
It depends where you are. If you're in the major cities in China, it's just about all electronic payment, very little cash. But in the smaller places, people still use the cash. So you can see that in these major commercial centres now, it's virtually all electronic.
I suppose people think that it's quicker and easier, don't they? And they don't really think about the other implications. Anyway, whereabouts are all these policies coming from in Hong Kong? I'd just like to know where, you know, because it doesn't sound to me as if they're going to the people and saying, what do you want? They're not. They're just saying, this is the way it's going to be. But who is saying that? Who's developing these policies?
Certain organizations, this is my view of it, they can freely move around the world, that have influence, resources, wealth, and a network, are the real people driving this policy. And these people are in organizations like universities, particularly London School of Economics, Oxford, and University College London. And I think, according to the Daily Mail, those three universities were at Bilderberg. That's what I read in the Daily Mail. Charity institutions, green groups, and the British consulate and other consular officers. These have offices and networks in many different countries, and they're highly influential. University networks, hugely, hugely powerful. For example, in Hong Kong, one of the professors at University College London was able to give a talk to all the judges on why AI, artificial intelligence, should be used in the judiciary to actually make judgments in a more effective way than judges making judgments, and that everybody should be using AI to settle legal disputes.
I mean, is there an argument for that? It might be quicker and cheaper to do it that way.
True, it may well be quicker and cheaper, but again, you've got the problem. Once you take the human element out of it, and the person that sets that computer controls the overall result.
Some people would say that actually taking the human factor out of it might be a good thing. It might make for more impartial decisions.
For me, my preference for law would be to have an open court with a jury every time and be judged by your peers, rather than by a judge, and least of all by a robot. I'm not a fan of that, because I think a jury takes into account not just the law, but a broader list of factors in reaching a decision. And I think they tend to reach, my view, better decisions than just judges on their own.
Have you had a wave of austerity in Hong Kong and that part of the world like we've had in Europe? Because that was, it's been, I mean, particularly horrendous for people who are low paid, etc. in Europe. It's caused such a problem that it, you know, it's starting to lead possibly to the breakup of the Brussels European Union, etc. I just wondered, have you had that wave of austerity over there, where it is enormous cuts to the public sector?
We haven't had cuts, no. I mean, the China economy, the mainland China economy, I think the last time I looked at it was growing about 6.8%, pretty healthy economic growth. And Hong Kong's growing at around 4% a year. The problem with Hong Kong is massively rising property prices, which wages have not kept up with. So people can't buy a property. For example, 600 square foot apartment is going to cost you about 1.2 million British pounds. And that's not in Central, that's out in Zhongguanou. That's a huge amount of money. Few people can afford property. So that eats, there's not been cuts, but the fact that the cost of things has increased means that people are worse off and wealth gaps are increasing.
Okay, well, what's your prediction, your crystal ball on the Hong Kong National Party? Will they survive the month?
Gosh, probably no. They're not a particularly big party. They don't have that many members. And there are other alternatives which have very similar, but rather than calling themselves independents, they talk about self-determination parties. And those two parties, Dem and Sisto, which is again run by students, is a far stronger party. I think the Hong Kong National Party, it's just not got any resources and it's unlikely to survive. I don't think it will survive.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Alison Weir. I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit organization in the U.S. called If Americans Knew. It's a journalistic organization to give Americans the facts on Israel and Palestine, and about especially the American connection.
Can you just talk us through the way that the relationship between the United States policy and Israel has changed over the decades?
I'd be glad to. It's done nothing, as you suggest, but really get closer and closer. What many people don't know, and certainly most, almost no Americans know, is that the movement for Israel became very active in the United States back in the late 1800s. That's when political Zionism began really everywhere. Most people, or at least many people, have heard of Theodore Herzl, who's considered the father of political Zionism, the movement that ultimately created Israel. But at the same time, and allied, very connected to that movement, was activism within the United States. So we're talking about in the late 1800s, there was already a movement in the U.S. to create a Jewish state in Palestine, even though at that time Palestine was fully inhabited and its population was about 95% non-Jewish. It was about 80% Muslim and about 15% Christian, a little under 5% Jewish. So that movement worldwide originally was not really very successful. Most Jews around the world, including within Palestine itself, opposed Zionism. Most Jewish Americans did not become Zionists, and some of them actively opposed Zionism. But the movement nevertheless became powerful by 1910. It was already considered a significant movement by politicians in the U.S., especially in the larger eastern cities. Then in, I think it was around 1914, a prominent American Supreme Court justice, Louis Brandeis, who's very famous. There's a university named after him. He's held in high regard by most Americans, especially those of us that are liberals or progressives, have always respected Brandeis. Well, it turns out that he became the head of World Zionism around 1914 or so. And then he was appointed to the Supreme Court by Woodrow Wilson. When you become a member of the Supreme Court, the normal behavior is to resign your board affiliations and your connections to various organizations because you're supposed to be neutral, or at least to be perceived as neutral. So Brandeis officially resigned his leadership of the World Zionist Organization, but and a number of books disclose this. He remained its leader for quite a while, and his loyal lieutenants would come into the Supreme Court chambers where Brandeis would give them directives to carry out. This is very little known by most Americans and is really considered highly unethical behavior. Then, to get into more of your question and the aspect of this that would probably be more interesting to English listeners, is that Brandeis became, not only was he the head of World Zionism, but he was a leader in what was, according to an article in a scholarly journal, a peer-reviewed Jewish scholarly journal, he was a leader in a secret Zionist society called the Parashim. Normally, I'm not one who believes or expects to find, quote, secret societies, but this was from the U.S. Jewish Historical Quarterly. It's also discussed in a mainstream book by a highly regarded author named Peter Gross, who was at the New York Times for many years, then at Harvard, wrote a number of nonfiction books. So I discovered this connection that Brandeis had to that society. And then reading from Dr. Sarah Schmidt, who's an Israeli professor, and Peter Gross, the American who used to be the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, write that a leader of the Parashim, a man named Horace Kallen, who was a professor first at Princeton, then at the University of Wisconsin, came up with the idea of suggesting to the British that they would gain a benefit from announcing a policy in support of Zionism, of creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This idea was suggested by Professor Kallen, an American, and made its way to Britain through various intermediaries in 1915. Now, at that time, Britain really had nothing to do with Palestine. Palestine at that time was under the Ottoman Empire. It was not yet under the British Empire, huge as the British Empire was. The sun did set on the British Empire in Palestine because Palestine was under the Ottomans. So why would Kallen suggest that the British would benefit from announcing a policy supporting Zionism? Well, the reason, it turns out, and this is in a number of books. If people get my book, you'll see that it's thoroughly cited. My book is half footnotes, literally. So everything I say, people can look at the source for it. In 1915, as I'm sure we all remember, that was World War I, what was called at the time the Great War. Britain was desperate to have the U.S. come into its side of the war. The first day of battle of the Battle of the Somme, British casualties were about 60,000 men in one day of battle. The problem from Britain's point of view and from the Zionists' point of view, as we'll see later, but from Britain's point of view, was that Americans did not want to enter the, quote, Great War. It had nothing to do with Americans. It was far away and really had really little interest to Americans. Woodrow Wilson was reelected to office with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But as I think I just said, the British government very much wanted the U.S. to come in on their side of the war. The Zionist leadership in Britain, especially a man named Chaim Weizmann, who later became president of Israel, went to the British government, and he made the claim that he and his colleagues in the U.S., and he especially referred to Brandeis, who was at that time in the Supreme Court and a good friend of Woodrow Wilson, he claimed that through Brandeis and other colleagues in the U.S., they could influence the U.S. to join the war on the side of Britain. And they said that they would do that if Britain would promise that it would then facilitate their efforts to have a Jewish state in Palestine. This is in a number of books, and it was referred to as the Gentleman's Agreement. This is how the Zionists, Israel partisans, although it wasn't yet Israel, so we have to use the political term, which is Zionists, managed to obtain this declaration. Mild as it is, really, in some ways, it opened the door to colonization of Palestine by Jewish immigrants and colonists. This is how they obtained the Balfour Declaration. And another very interesting aspect of it that, again, most of us didn't know, but it seems to be corroborated in a number of books, is that the actual author of the declaration was not Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister at the time. It was actually a secret Zionist named Leopold Amory. Again, this came out from a Jewish historian who's very eminent Jewish historian, wrote about this in an article that I first read in the San Francisco Jewish Bulletin, and in a more extensive article and elsewhere, he goes into more detail about Leopold Amory and his secret connections to Zionism and how much he worked so on behalf of Zionism within the British government. And he was the one that authored the final wording of what's called the Balfour Declaration. But that wording had previously, before it was finalized by Amory, it had gone back and forth between Britain and the United States. Zionists in the United States had helped draft what's called the Balfour Declaration. That's how the U.S. played a major role and was used by Zionists to ultimately create Israel, because the Balfour Declaration, even though I, for many years, did not consider it very major because what it states is not very strong, really. But when you crack a door open, then it's pretty easy to push it open the rest of the way. And that's basically what the Balfour Declaration did. But at that time, still, most Americans, including the large majority of Jewish Americans, were not yet Zionists. We're talking about a small but very fanatic group that already had managed to obtain quite a bit of funding. It was at that time starting to already get some funding from some banking families, such as the Schiff family. The Rothschild family was providing funding to political Zionism. So it had already become a major player worldwide in 1915 and basically in 1917 when the Balfour Declaration was formally issued.
What about, you mentioned banking, what about Lord Rothschild, Lionel Rothschild? I believe the Balfour Declaration was actually written to him.
It was. That also is usually left out when people talk about the Balfour Declaration. I think the attempt is, and it's largely successful, is to make this seem like a high-level, well-thought-out British policy. But this was a policy, this was written to Lord Rothschild, who is another Zionist leader. So here we have a declaration authored by a secret Zionist, but, again, if people go to my book, it's called Against Our Better Judgment, and read my footnotes and see all the different sources for this. We have a declaration written by a secret Zionist, co-authored and drafted by a number of Zionists, both in Britain and in the United States, and then written to a British Zionist named Rothschild. All of that is normally left out whenever, you read any history of Israel and Zionism, and you'll hear about the Balfour Declaration, this will be discussed. But almost never will those important facts be part of the picture.
Sounds like a very long-term project, actually, with a lot of secrecy as well, with the secret society involved. That always helps obscure what it's really about. What's the ultimate aim? Other than the creation of the State of Israel, what was the point? Why put so much effort into this?
Well, I think there will be different views about that. I always go with the I don't jump to conspiracy theories. I really look for facts, and then I look at what those facts show. And often there's a very clear pattern. In this case, the minimum that was being attempted was what they succeeded in achieving was to create a Jewish state in Palestine, to basically steal somebody else's land, kick off the majority of the inhabitants, both Muslims, Christians, and there were a few other groups, you know, kick them off, take over that land, create a nation state that now the rest of the world is told, quote, has the right to exist, which basically is saying somehow they had the right to expel, forcibly, violently expel the indigenous population, discriminate the remnants of the indigenous population, and become such a powerful nation that they now drive U.S. policies.
Well, hang on, because it's an interesting relationship, a bit like the relationship between the UK as well, the relationship between Israel and the United States. Who wears the trousers in that relationship now?
Israel. You know, this is the part that a lot of people that claim to be Palestine solidarity activists, and many of whom I believe really are, but are reluctant to believe, and certainly extremely reluctant for other people to know, that Israel is the decisive member of this relationship between the U.S. and Israel. It's not surprising that it's, you know, hard for some people to believe. Many Jewish activists really just are in denial and don't want to believe it for sort of, you know, because of human nature. I think it's you know, often it's that simple.
Well, what evidence have you got for that, though?
Well, both the historic evidence, because when you look through who pushed this, who succeeded in pushing Zionism, this was done by Jewish groups, by Zionist groups. The State Department, the U.S. State Department, was opposed to it. There were numerous documents, memos, studies, reports, all opposing Zionism. The Pentagon was opposing Zionism for many decades. The Secretary of Defense, Forrestal, opposed Zionism. The intelligence agencies in the U.S. opposed Zionism. All of them wrote detailed memos about how damaging to the U.S. support of Zionism would be. There's a very clear written record of the U.S. establishment opposing Zionism. Christians, some of the most celebrated Christian pastors oppose Zionism. A Dead Sea scholar wrote a very powerful book about the responsibility that Christians had to support Palestinian human rights. So historically, there's a very clear documentary record that this was not being pushed by the usual suspects that often do run things. It was not pushed, surprisingly enough, by the military-industrial group. It was not pushed by the Pentagon. It's quite clear that it was pushed by this very fervent special interest group.
So, I mean, it sounds to me as if you're saying that there is a Jewish conspiracy.
Well, I would be more precise than that, because there were also during these years Jewish groups that were opposing it, that were actively speaking out against it. There was it was called the American Council for Judaism, publicly opposed it. Alfred Lilienthal, a Jewish author, wrote a number of excellent books exposing Zionism. There were some rabbis. So a Jewish conspiracy suggests that it was all Jews, and that it was the majority of Jews, at least. It certainly was not all Jews, and it was not a majority of Jews from most of the movement's existence.
What about more up to date, though? I know you've got an action alert out at the moment about more money that seems to be going to Israel from the U.S.
We have now in the U.S. a bill that the U.S. media have not even reported on that's in Congress that would give Israel $38 billion over the next 10 years. That works out to over $23,000 for each Jewish Israeli family of four. Would be getting $23,000 from American taxpayers. This has been introduced into both houses of Congress, both the House of Representatives and the Senate. It passed the a committee with a large majority in the Senate already. Only one person objected to that, Rand Paul. And yet, this is not even being reported to the American public.
So how much money every year, how much money every year goes from the U.S. to Israel?
The number we've been using to make it just sort of a simple round number has been over $10 million per day of American tax money to Israel. And that's the conservative number. That's the official number from the Congressional Research Service. There's additional money on top of that. There's also a much greater cost to Americans. The cost to Americans is at least, and this is even before it's gone up, this new bill makes it even larger. But the cost to the average American or to American taxpayers has been about $15 million per day.
So that works out least. Around about $3.5 or $4 billion a year.
That's right. It goes between $3 and $4 billion per year, and it's been going on for a long time. U.S. taxpayers, unknown to us, we never read about this in our media or hear about it on TV, but American taxpayers have been giving to the tiny state of Israel more of our tax money than we've given to anybody else, than to all the starving countries of Africa put together. In fact, on average, per capita, Israelis get 6,000 times more American money than other people around the world.
Now, you call your charity If Americans Knew. How did you, and what was it that made you decide to call it that, and how did you come to start it? What drove you to start it?
Well, I started it. It's a very, very simple, clear story. Like most Americans, I knew almost nothing about Israel-Palestine. I certainly was sympathetic to Israel. I felt that was, quote, our side, I think unconsciously. But then in fall of 2000, when the second Palestinian uprising began, called the Second Intifada, this was in the news a bit, in U.S. news media, and I finally decided at that point in my life to pay attention. I was just curious, what's Israel-Palestine about? When I paid attention to it, my background is journalism, I noticed very quickly that we were getting one-sided reporting. We were getting very pro-Israel reporting. Because the internet had just become available for research, I looked into it further, started to discover that during this time, Israeli forces were killing and injuring large, very large numbers of Palestinian men, women, and children. And this was being covered up in the U.S. news media, the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, NPR. So after a few months of getting drawn in more and more, the more I looked into it, the more I felt this was the largest cover-up I had ever seen. And, of course, we've seen many. So after a few months, I quit my job. I was the editor of a very small local weekly newspaper, and I traveled over to Gaza and the West Bank in early 2001 as a freelance reporter and saw firsthand what Israel was doing to Palestinians. So when I came back, I started an organization that was to be nonpartisan, non-ideological, and try to give the facts about Israel-Palestine and the U.S. connection to every possible American that we can reach with that information.
Now, some people say that the Israelis are planning a massive war with Iran, which could precipitate Armageddon. Now, there's a sort of inevitability that if that happens, surely that's just all – it's going to be impossible to stop. So what do you say to people like that?
Well, certainly – Israel has been targeting Iran for a very long time, and Israel partisans in the U.S., the group of them called neoconservatives, which are largely motivated by their passion for Israel, have Iran in their sights. You know, they wanted to destroy Iraq. The U.S. invaded Iraq on behalf of Israel. Syria has been destroyed largely, and Iran is the major country that Israel partisans want destroyed. I'm actually writing a long article about this right now. From the beginning, Israel realized that it needed to dominate the entire Middle East. It needed to have hegemony in the region. And there were two ways to do that. One was to get money and weaponry from other countries, which they have done. The other is to prevent any other country in the region from becoming sufficiently successful that it could challenge Israel and that it could successfully advocate for Palestinian human rights. Iran is the one that's left. Pretty much everybody else has either been bought off or destroyed. So Iran is left, and so far they have succeeded in a great deal. There has not been a full-out military attack, although they have done a number of violent attacks on Iran. They've assassinated some young Iranian scientists, and they've gotten the U.S. and the rest of the world to have a blockade against Iran, which is really, I believe, according to international law, an act of war already.
So, I mean, do you think the Netanyahu and the Israeli government are going to get their war with Iran?
I think that they're hoping that the U.S. will damage Iran so badly that they can keep their hands clean and not lose any Jewish lives. My book is entitled Against Our Better Judgment: The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. Our website is ifamericansknew.org, and we also have a blog that we post to every day. So if people go to If Americans Knew, our main website, you can also find there the link to the blog, which has new information being posted every day.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you want at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Robert Hansen from Hong Kong and also Alison Weir from the charity If Americans Knew. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
I think the story of Boudica is that it shows when things go wrong. After all, Boudica didn't want to be a rebel. You know, she didn't want to fight the Romans. She's just so badly mistreated by them that she gets to the point where there is no other alternative. You know, what do you do when you've been abused to that extent? What have you got left other than to try and fight?
We'll dive into the history of the Roman occupation of Great Britain, including the response by Queen Boudica's with her sacking of London. Our guest is ancient Roman scholar Adrian Goldsworthy, author of the book Hadrian's Wall. We'll also discuss the nature of Roman occupation and the warlike nature of the ancient democratic and republican systems.
It's one of those strange things about the ancient world is that the democracies do tend to be very aggressive, particularly the big ones. In part because often the voters can see a benefit from this, and certainly the political class can see, especially in Rome, the opportunities for glory, for profit.
Adrian Goldsworthy joins us next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Republican Senator Rand Paul blocked Independent Senator Bernie Sanders' effort to pass a resolution to protect U.S. election systems from Russian interference. Sanders' resolution also said President Donald Trump has to cooperate with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. And Sanders wanted to put the Senate on record as standing by U.S. intelligence agencies' assessment that Russia intervened in the election that put Trump in the White House.
If we are serious about preserving American democracy, we must demand, and I know this is a radical idea, but demand that the President of the United States represent the interests of the American people and not Russia.
Republican Senator Rand Paul accused Sanders and Democrats of acting on hatred of the president to block diplomacy with Russia.
Trump derangement syndrome has officially come to the Senate. The hatred for the president is so intense that partisans would rather risk war than give diplomacy a chance with the Russians.
Sanders was trying to advance his proposal by unanimous consent, but that means it takes only one senator's objection to block it. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. says President Trump made important verbal agreements with President Vladimir Putin during their private conversation in Helsinki. Anatoly Antonov listed cooperation in Syria and arms control as two issues the world leaders had agreed on. The Washington Post reports that the highest level Trump administration officials still don't know what Trump promised Putin during their one-on-one meeting, which lasted more than 2 hours. The Post reported that officials are scrambling to figure out what Trump agreed to. The push for a federal Medicare for All single-payer system of health care received a boost. House Democrats Pramila Jayapal of Washington, Debbie Dingell of Michigan, and Keith Ellison of Minnesota announced creation of a House caucus dedicated to pushing for passage of H.R. 6767, the Medicare for All legislation. The measure now has 122 House sponsors, nearly two-thirds of all Democrats. Jayapal said health care must be accessible and affordable to every resident of the United States.
One of the best ways to ensure health care for all is to use the system that already exists for millions of seniors over the last half century, and that is Medicare. The Congressional Medicare for All Caucus will help build the evidence base for Medicare for All. And let me say that all of us understand that this has been a process and a journey, and that the Affordable Care Act was a piece of getting to the place where people understood that things like pre-existing conditions should be covered, that people on Medicare, Medicaid should have much greater access, and it has allowed us to get to the place where now we need to take the next step.
Jayapal said that next step is working through the research and the challenges and making sure supporters understand how to craft and implement a Medicare for All system. Israel's parliament approved contentious legislation that defines the country as the nation state of the Jewish people and makes Hebrew the only official language, downgrading Arabic to special standing. The vote was 62-55 and came in the early morning after 8 hours of heated debate. The government says the bill will merely enshrine into law Israel's existing character. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called its passage a historic moment in the history of Zionism and the history of the State of Israel. Palestinian Arabs make up about 20% of the Israeli population. The head of the Arab list in the Knesset called it an evil law and said it would deny the rights of Palestinians. Member of Parliament Yusuf Jabarin spoke to Al Jazeera after the vote.
This is a bill from a government that is an enemy to Palestinians. It's the most dangerous measure. It's a law from a racist government against Palestinian rights, and it creates an apartheid regime. It turns Israel into a fascist state.
The American Jewish community said it was deeply disappointed and that the law puts at risk the commitment of Israel's founders to build a country that is both Jewish and democratic. A groundbreaking court ruling in Lebanon says that consensual sex between people of the same gender is not illegal. Human Rights Watch hailed the ruling as the first such decision from an appeals court in Lebanon and says it moves the country further towards decriminalization. A Human Rights Watch researcher said the Lebanese court has effectively ordered the state to get out of people's bedrooms. I'm Eileen Alfandari. Letters and Politics is next.
Welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. A quick note here about upcoming shows that I'm pretty excited about. Next week, my home radio station, KPFA, that's where we broadcast out of, as well as probably a lot of other community radio stations will be, if they're not already in, a short summer fun drive. During these type of times, during these fun drives, I try to bring the very best of what we do on this radio program. So starting next Tuesday, we're going to be bringing a brand new series of shows that include a conversation with Stephen Greenblatt, Pulitzer Prize winning author, about the politics of William Shakespeare and how his analysis of politics is still very relevant today. You know, we are living in Shakespearean type of times. Another show we'll have is with Kyle Harper on how natural climate change and disease went hand in hand with both the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire. And, you know, the Romans thought they had conquered nature in their day. So we'll talk about that. We'll also look at how the early Christians destroyed the classical world from Athens to Alexandria with classicist Catherine Nixie. And we'll explore the life of Zora Neale Hurston, and especially her life as an anthropologist and her quest to save and record African-American folklore and her first manuscript that has just now, for the first time, been turned into a book about a man by the name of Oluwale Kosola, who in 1927 was the last living African kidnapped from Africa, enslaved in America, and then had to forge a new life after the end of slavery in the South. So for that conversation, we'll speak to Zora Neale Hurston scholar Deborah Plant. So that's all beginning next Tuesday, and I'm very much looking forward to that. I hope you understand that this week I'm spending much of my time trying to get ready for those jobs, for those interviews. It's a tough job, I know. So today I want to whet your appetite a little bit with the conversation about the outskirts of the Roman Empire. That's where most of the opposition to the empire could be found. That's where it was its fiercest. And we're going to focus specifically on Great Britain. In fact, the name Britain comes from the Roman Latin term Britannia. And for that conversation, I spoke to Adrian Goldsworthy. Adrian Goldsworthy is a scholar of the Roman Empire. He's the author of the book Hadrian's Wall. This is the wall that could be found in northern England. And this was the furthermost western expansion of the Roman Empire. And then on the other side, you would have what they would call barbarians, the Celtic tribes. And so I spoke to Adrian Goldsworthy just a couple of weeks ago, and we did it via Skype. Goldsworthy, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to our program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell me about the world that the Roman Empire found, that Julius Caesar, I guess, found when he first arrived on the island, which today we call Great Britain?
It's something that, I mean, Caesar only really reached the southeast, and what he talks about probably only applies to that area. Linguistically, these are people who are speaking Celtic languages. These days, it's not very fashionable for the archaeologists to view all Celts as very similar in terms of culture and organization. The Greeks and the Romans present them that way. They tend to describe them as all having, you know, the same sort of tribal structure. They have chiefs, they have kings, they have high kings over them. The tribes are always fighting each other. They're headhunters. You know, they take people's heads as trophies and display them on their buildings. They do human sacrifice. They get up to all sorts of things like that. There's a mixture. There's a variation. Warfare does appear to be very, very common in Britain, as it was in most of Iron Age Europe. And you're basically dealing with that culture. But there are a lot of problems in that some areas we have a rather poor archaeological record for what's going on. It's one of those drawbacks that often the best finds archaeologically, when people are living in quite simple round houses, you might find post holes in the houses, but the objects you find tend to be with grave goods. If they bury somebody and put things in the grave, the problem is if you then have a culture or a tribe who doesn't bury anybody, but perhaps, like some of the Native American peoples, exposes the bodies on platforms, that's going to leave almost no archaeological trace whatsoever. So there are areas of Britain where we really don't know too much about the people, other than broadly, this is the sort of pottery they're using, this is the sort of metalwork they're using, and they live in these round houses. And that sort of material is quite hard to date. One thing that is important to remember, not just about Britain, but about the whole Roman Empire, is that wherever the Romans go, many of the locals welcome them. And there are many tribes, leaders, kings and queens who never, ever fight against Rome. Instead, they see the Romans as a big, powerful friend to protect them against the neighboring tribe and the neighboring peoples against whom they've been fighting for generations. And they've got those sorts of grudges that have been about cattle raiding and tribal problems and disputes and warfare for generations, perhaps centuries. That's far more important to you than this strange foreign empire that appears and, generally speaking, doesn't interfere too much in your daily life. However, although the Romans don't consciously interfere because they're really too lazy and they don't have a big administrative system, they like people to become more like them. So they encourage the aristocracy to live in Roman villas, to start speaking Latin, they give them Roman citizenship and then try and encourage them to buy into the imperial system, have a career in it, and also start being local magistrates, local priests, all the things the Romans understand. The Romans really understand cities and city life, and that's the way they'd like to view the world. In Britain, you have some towns and cities, but especially in the north, people just don't seem to like living in that sort of environment. So you end up with lots of little settlements around the country, but they still start to become more Roman. And, you know, there you have a currency. You can see in sites on Hadrian's Wall and around it that luxury goods and quite ordinary goods from hundreds, even thousands of miles away in other parts of the empire are readily available to quite ordinary people. Very, very quickly, this becomes part of the major imperial economy. And goods are moving around, people are moving around, and it's much harder to trace them archaeologically, but probably ideas, maybe even jokes and songs and tunes are moving around. Because this is a far more cosmopolitan world than anything that had happened in the Iron Age before, when people generally didn't move around so much.
I guess beyond the archaeological record, everything we've learned, whether it be about the Celtic tribes in what we call today Great Britain, I guess Britain itself is a Latin term, or even throughout areas around Germany and France today, everything that we know about these people comes from Roman historians or Roman writers themselves.
Yes, that's the problem. You're dealing with, in the Iron Age peoples, these are not literate cultures, so they don't leave any records. The closest you get are some of the poems that are not written down until the early Middle Ages in Ireland, where you have a very similar tribal organization. You've got things like the Ulster Cycle, the Tales of Cú Chulainn, and the Toyne, the Cattle Raid of Cooley, the central sort of epic of this cycle of stories about heroes who ride in chariots, who chop off each other's heads and keep them as trophies, who have very powerful queens, who seem to be quite similar to the impression we get of the Celts described by the Greeks and Romans. And that's about the only time where you maybe just get a glimpse, albeit one written down centuries later, of their own view of this world. But otherwise, it's deeply frustrating, is that when you simply have artifacts and when you have burials and when you have settlements, to understand the stories of these people, how they thought, what this meant to them, is almost impossible, because all of that has gone, all that oral tradition. We don't know the tribal names that appear for groups like the Brigantes in northern Britain or the Iceni in Norfolk in the southeast. These are names written down by the Romans or by the Greeks, and we don't know to what extent someone would have actually identified themselves as a member of that tribe. Was the tribe the most important thing? Was it your family? Was it some clan, some section within it? All of that, all the detail, all of the things that they would have taken for granted, we simply don't know. So we're guessing at what we think was probably there, but very hard to say precisely how it worked and what it meant to people.
If most tribes welcomed the Roman Empire, then why did the empire stop where Hadrian's Wall is? And I realize it went further for a short period of time and then receded again to where Hadrian's Wall is. Why didn't it continue going north through up through to Ireland?
It's one of those strange things in that, again, it's a problem, is that we don't know as much about Roman Britain at all as we would like. There are some tribes that are very hostile and fight the Romans for a long period, although all those south of the wall eventually submit, and there's no real evidence for rebellions against Rome. You know, the last one in southern Britain is in AD 60, when Queen Boudicca burns down what would become London, and a couple of other major towns. But when that's defeated, there appears to be no repeat of it at all. On the other hand, Roman Britain always has what seems to be a disproportionately big garrison. The Roman army is a professional army, which means it's very expensive. Now, no government likes spending money when it doesn't have to. The other thing we have to remember with Roman emperors is that not only was the army expensive, and it is the single, by far the biggest element within the imperial budget, but the Roman army also poses a threat to emperors, because very few emperors will get killed by a foreign enemy. Even the Persians in the east, the great empire there, managed to defeat and kill only a couple of them. Particularly from the 3rd century AD onwards, and it's always a threat before that, the Romans fight civil war after civil war when Roman soldiers proclaim their general as a leader, as a new emperor, and go off and fight rival emperors. And this happens there from 218 AD onwards, right to the end of the Roman Empire in the West in the late 5th century. There are only 3 decades without a civil war. This is something that just goes on and on and on. So it means that concentrating a lot of soldiers in one place is actually a big risk to the emperor. So it's really something that on every grounds they don't want to do. And yet, Britain has one of the biggest armies in the entire empire. And it keeps a very large army right the way through its history. So there's obviously a reason why. There is a military problem there as far as the Romans are concerned. And it looks as if the wall and this garrison is one way of one approach to dealing with this problem. In the 80s AD, the Romans march right up to almost the very north of Scotland. They don't quite go to the tip. However, they do. Parts of the Roman navy sails around the top of Scotland. They visit some of the islands, probably the Orkneys. And it's only at that point the Romans are absolutely convinced and prove that Britain is an island. They weren't sure. They didn't know whether it may have been a continent, that it just went on and on. On at least one occasion, they talk about intervening in Ireland, and there are princes or kings, exiles from Ireland, who come to them, ask for help to be reinstated in power. That, as far as we can tell, never happens. They occupy northern Scotland. They build a legionary fortress up there in the 80s AD, and within a few years, abandon it. And they abandon this complicated line of outposts, of turrets, of towers, all on the edge of the Scottish Highlands, controlling all the glens, all the valleys that went through that area. So at that point, they've obviously thought about, well, let's occupy virtually all of the island. Within a few years, there's a crisis on the Danube, troops are needed elsewhere, the garrison of Britain is reduced, troops go back. And that's the time when they drop back to the frontier line that will become Hadrian's Wall a generation or so later. So I think they've wondered about it, but it's almost a sort of accountancy problem. It's a cost and profit balance, because if they're going to control that area, they'll need a lot of soldiers. But if they put a lot of soldiers up there, the soldiers are expensive, the revenue they get in terms of taxation is going to be quite poor, because this is not a wealthy area. There aren't a lot of mineral resources out there. The population isn't that huge. Although some parts of southern Scotland are very well cultivated in this period, nevertheless, this is not a spectacularly wealthy part of even compared to the rest of Roman Britain. So I think there's a decision that how do we best dominate this area? Because it's vital to remember that Hadrian's Wall is built as a barrier to other people coming south. It's never meant as a barrier to the Romans. There are outpost forts beyond the wall for most of its history. And the Roman army intervenes very far to the north whenever it wants to. Diplomatically, the Roman presence is clearly there as well. And we can see this in hordes of Roman silver coins that have been buried quite far up in northern Scotland, are presumably gifts to kings, to chieftains, to stay friends with Rome, not to cause a problem. It's a fairly traditional way of empires. You know, you use force, but you also use bribery to keep anybody happy. And what's quite interesting is that this clearly up here is not a monetary economy. You know, these are not coins that somebody spends. They are simply valuable almost as bullion for the leaders. So it's, this is silver, this is gold that I can show off how rich, how powerful I am, and I can give out as gifts, or that I can simply afford to bury in hordes of 300 or more coins and leave for to be discovered by archaeologists 2,000 years later. So all the way through, this is a sort of ongoing pattern. The problem is we just don't know enough about the changing balance of power between the tribes, the rise and fall of individual leaders, which ones are hostile, which ones are friendly, which ones vary between the two. We get glimpses of this in the sources. There are clearly changes at the end of the second century, beginning of the third century, which prompts the Emperor Septimius Severus himself to come to Britain with a major army and campaign again quite far to the north of Scotland and build some bases that are occupied at least for a decade or so before they're abandoned. So there are different ways of dealing with the problem, and almost certainly the military problem, the political problem the Romans are dealing with also changes. It's just that we're, again, we don't have the accounts to tell us what's really going on. We're just guessing.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Adrian Goldsworthy. Adrian Goldsworthy is a renowned historian of the classical world. He's the author of a number of books on the Roman Empire, and we're talking about his book, Hadrian's Wall. Adrian Goldsworthy, I hope you'll indulge me here to go off topic a little bit, but I feel like I just have to ask you to tell us the story of Queen Boudica.
Right.
And I say well, off topic because she sacks London, which is Londinium, and that's where it's a Latin term, and that's where we get the word London from.
Yeah, and there's a settlement of beginning as merchants. It's always a commercial city, which is quite interesting, on the River Thames. Some of them may well be there even before the Romans arrive, and certainly within years of the Roman occupation, this is flourishing as a town. Because you have to remember, the Romans have only landed in Britain in AD 43. Boudica is 17 years later in AD 60. And she's part of a tribe that have welcomed the Romans, that haven't fought them. Her husband is King Prasutagus, who's an ally of the Roman people, but he dies in AD 60. Now, something that's clearly happened and happens in a lot of provinces is that as the Roman army arrives, so do the bankers, so do the moneylenders, so do the people telling you how they'll give you lots and lots of money and you won't have to pay it back for a long time and you can spend it on all these luxury items that the empire offers. You can start to show off just how very Roman you are. And, you know, don't worry about the payments. We'll sort that out later as the interest builds up. You're introducing a whole system of loans and exchange that's completely unfamiliar to the locals. And we know that Seneca, one of the Emperor Nero's major advisors, who later will be forced to commit suicide because Nero turns against him, he's got huge investments in Britain in this way. So it's seen as a sort of big money-making opportunity. Now, when the king dies, Boudica hopes that her daughters will be able to inherit as queens of the tribe. The problem is, in Roman law, the status of an allied king doesn't actually allow him, except unless it's a special, special privilege, to bequeath his throne to anybody. So he makes, Prasutagus makes his daughters and Nero joint heirs. The Romans interpret this as simply, well, you know, it's a gift to the emperor, it's up to the emperor to decide what's going to happen. Unfortunately, as is so often the case when you get these meetings between different cultures, many of the men on the spot are the worst possible people to choose for this situation. You know, you think some of the commissioners sent out to deal with the plains tribes before the Sioux uprising and this sort of thing. They're the people who are going to make things worse. And in this case, the blame is passed by the Romans onto a procurator, a financial official, the man who helped the emperor collect taxes in that region, who goes to Boudica's capital somewhere in Norfolk and demands money instantly. He demands repayment also of all these debts that the king's run up. When Boudica resists at being treated this way, he has her publicly flogged. Her daughters are raped by his officials. You know, it's a really nasty, savage incident, which unsurprisingly outrages Boudica, who, say, up until now has been an ally of Rome. And so have her people. You know, they've thought of the Romans as friends. Suddenly they're being treated in this appalling way. So the anger from that blends with other anger. The neighboring tribe, who were never particular friends of the Iceni, have had part of their land confiscated to build a settlement for Roman veteran soldiers, discharged soldiers who were given a farm, have often taken local wives, and who settled down in the province at a place called Canulodonum. Again, people who've come in as conquerors aren't necessarily the most tactful neighbours, and particularly when they've taken your property. So there's a lot of hatred there. It all comes together. It's an interesting pattern that usually within about a generation of the conquest of an area by Rome, there is a major, major rebellion. And if that's defeated, on the whole, things go calmer. So one of the reasons is that within that generation, you've had enough time for young warriors to grow up who never fought the Romans. So, you know, they haven't seen what the Roman army is like and just how formidable and how strong the empire is. And they're keen to prove themselves. And you add in some of these acts of unnecessary brutality on the part of the Roman government. This is not how an official is supposed to behave. The Romans condemn him, but on the other hand, he clearly thought he could get away with it. Boudicca raises a very big army. She burns down Canulodonum first, massacres everybody there. She moves on to Londinium. This hasn't even got any walls to protect it. Wasn't thought necessary. The Roman army at this stage is away in the west of the province fighting just off the coast of North Wales. They've destroyed the centre of the Druidic cult. So, again, you've probably got a religious element to all this. The established religion of the tribes has suddenly been thrown into chaos by the Romans. So, you know, there's an element of sort of almost apocalyptic fears about all of this, that everyone, this is a very nervous time, and it just explodes into this incredibly brutal rebellion. Because in Londinium, again, Boudicca and her army massacre everybody. And bear in mind, most of the occupants of these towns, yes, they're civilians, but also very many of them are Romans. And they move on to the tribal capital of Verulanium, modern-day St. Albans, of the Atrebates, another allied tribe. So again, they're massacring fellow Britons, but ones who've sided with the Romans. Some tribes stay loyal to Rome, some defect and join Boudicca. There are stories very quickly of these really nasty atrocities of torture, of mutilation, of all sorts of things. And it's one of those rare occasions where the Roman army, the Roman soldiers, get really angry as well. Normally, all ancient warfare is brutal, but there's an element of sort of self-interest in the way they fight. But in the confrontation with Boudicca's rebels, when the army comes back from North Wales, and even though hugely outnumbered, manages to choose a good location and meets Boudicca and her rebels in battle, the Romans win, but not only do they win, they massacre everyone they can catch. And they start even killing the animals, the mules, the horses that the Britons had had with them. Now, normally you take prisoners because, brutal though it is in the ancient world, human life has a value because you can sell people as slaves. So it isn't in the soldiers' interest to go and slaughter everybody. But on this occasion, they do that. And it's almost unprecedented. They never really, they're clearly both terrified and extremely angry. So you end up with a situation where the savagery sort of spirals out of control and gets worse and worse on each side as everybody does something terrible and then the other side matches it with something worse and so on and so on. Boudicca vanishes. She's defeated and we don't really know what happens to her. It's said that she died soon afterwards. One source says maybe she took poison, perhaps she was ill. We don't really know what happened to her. We don't know what happened to her daughters. Significantly, her tribe, the Iceni, never seemed terribly prosperous throughout the rest of the history of Roman Britain. You know, they're okay. There are people there. They farm. They get on with things. But compared to the wealth they'd had before, it never really recovers. And something else that's quite strange happens, because the Roman governor who's put down the rebellion is replaced less than a year later. And the official reason is the loss of some warships in a storm. But according to our main source, that's written by Senator Tacitus, he's actually replaced because he was considered to be too brutal, that he'd got to the point where he hated the Britons so much that he couldn't be an effective governor. So it's, although there's a grim, really nasty story of coercive, vicious imperialism with Boudicca, you also get the reminder that the Romans, you know, they don't think this is how you should behave. This is clearly when things go wrong. Yes, they're the masters. Yes, they're the conquerors. But actually, they want to treat people fairly well because they want people to be happy because they really don't want them to rebel. Rebellions are dangerous. They're expensive. there was a genuine fear at this point that the province would be lost. But because of that one battle where Boudicca's defeated, it crumbles, and then over the next months, the rebellion is put down pretty brutally. So it's one of those stories. Boudicca, the name, probably came from the goddess of victory, Buddha. So it meant Victoria, basically. So it's one of those things in the 19th century under Queen Victoria, she was promoted as a heroine of Britain. And there's a statue of her riding her chariot outside the Houses of Parliament to this day that was put up in that period. So again, she's one of those figures that gets used and reused and turned into a story. But we don't know too much about the real person. And when you look at the history, it seems, you know, it's pretty brutal. It's not very flattering for anybody on either side.
Do you think that then the conditions that led to the rebellion, maybe not perhaps the rebellion or as big as the rebellion would be or grandiose as it would all become, but the conditions that at least led to the rebellion was a similar experience throughout Great Britain with the Roman Empire, and perhaps, and I know oftentimes we don't know for sure a lot when we talk about the ancient world, we have to speculate sometimes, but perhaps the people beyond Hadrian's Wall heard about this and sort of fortified their opposition to the expansion of the Roman Empire?
It could be. I mean, the arrival of the Romans, if you don't welcome them, can be a really unpleasant experience. You know, this is the ancient world where, as I say, if you get captured in war, you'll be sold as a slave. If you're lucky, you might end up fighting to the death in the arena. And, you know, nobody wants a load of foreigners coming in and telling them what to do. However, again, you've got to remember, when Boudicca rebels, some tribes join her, others stay loyal, which again rather suggests, well, two things. One is that life wasn't actually too bad for those people, but also there is very little fellow feeling of other one tribe to another, and that the Romans often are a more acceptable friend and ally than another tribe in Britain. So I think the story of Boudicca is that it shows when things go wrong. After all, Boudicca didn't want to be a rebel. You know, she didn't want to fight the Romans. She's just so badly mistreated by them that she gets to the point where there is no other alternative. You know, what do you do when you've been abused to that extent? What have you got left other than to try and fight? But mostly that doesn't happen, because most Roman officials are better than that, in part because, you know, the emperor will try and punish Boudicca. He doesn't want people to do that. I mean, there's a famous quote from the Emperor Tiberius, comes from a bit earlier than Roman Britain, where he talks about his governors and says, you know, I want you to shear my flock, not flay them alive. You know, don't skin them. Just take off the wool so we can take off more wool next year and next year and next year. The Romans run their empire for a profit. It isn't profitable if people are forced into poverty, if they're also so desperate that they're going to rebel against you. So I think in the main, things are much better than that. Boudicca is a sign of things going wrong, and there isn't a rebellion like that after AD 60 for the next 350 years in lowland Britain, which suggests the Romans are getting it right, that even if people don't necessarily like them, that life is tolerable compared to the alternative. You know the risks of rebellion, you know how bad it can be. So, you know, okay, this is not too bad, I can put up with this. Quite a lot of people actually do extremely well under the Roman system and become far more prosperous, far better off. So, you know, a lot of them are becoming Roman citizens. So they buy into it. It may be that people in the north, you know, are aware that the Romans are coming thinking, well, we're offering civilization, all this sort of thing. And they look at it and think, well, I don't think much of that. I prefer to stay as I am. Thank you very much. There's clearly not large parts of northern Britain beyond the wall that wants to be Roman. You know, there might be allies, but they're definitely not encouraging the Romans to come in and rule them. But also the population there is much more scattered, it's much lower. The advantages are probably getting a little bit less certain. However, there is one telltale truth that isn't just the case in Britain, but throughout the Roman Empire in the West. And that's, if you leap to the end and go to the 5th century AD, when Roman administration in Britain ends round about 410 AD. Elsewhere in Gaul, modern-day France, Spain, it goes on a bit longer, but by the end of the 5th century, it's gone everywhere. In none of those provinces do you have an independence movement of people who want to be Britons or Gauls or Spanish. which if you compare that to the 20th century empires in Africa, in Asia, all the independence movements, say, you know, Gandhi in India, the different leaders in Africa and elsewhere, you know, who wanted to be free, they wanted to be independent. As the Roman Empire falls apart, everybody's still desperate to be Roman because the Romans have just been there so long. You know, it's 350, 60 years in Britain. It's even longer in places like Gaul. No one can remember a time before Rome, and none of the barbarian groups that are coming in are really offering anything that's more appealing. So all your identity has become, and the sense of civilization, of a comfortable life, of peace, is tied up with being Roman. So in Britain, as elsewhere, over time, people just get used to the idea. They accept it as normal. You know, it's very hard. In fact, by the 5th century, it's difficult for people to imagine a world without Rome, even though it will fairly soon fall to pieces. So I think there are warnings from how the Romans behave, and certainly, you know, the Romans can be deeply provocative, they can be cruel, they do exploit. However, you've got to balance it. They are, in the end, quite pragmatic, and they are really doing this for, you know, it's another, slightly as a digression, but if you go back to the Emperor Augustus in the beginning of the first century AD, poets like Horace and others are trying to tell him, go and conquer Britain, go and complete what Julius Caesar started. This will be great for the glory of Rome. The emperor doesn't do it. And one source writing soon afterwards says, well, you know, we looked at how much it would cost in terms of the garrison we'd need for Britain, and we thought that's not going to be actually profitable compared to the revenue we're going to get there. So it's better for us to levy tolls on goods coming from Britain when they reach the continent and the empire, and just have allies in Britain and sort of send diplomatic missions. So, you know, the whole decision to conquer Britain in the first place was probably one that went against pragmatism but was necessary for the glory of the emperor. And the empire does sort of expand or not expand rather like that, depending on the politics internally. So it's quite complicated on both sides.
I find that interesting. And my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, about the Roman Empire in general, and it did expand at times and receded at times, but mostly stayed about the same. The most imperial conquest happened when Rome was what we'd still consider to be a republic.
Yes, that's very much the case. And it's particularly in the last century or so of the Republic's history when it moves from the Mediterranean world and just sort of, it seems almost to explode. And Julius Caesar will push up to the Atlantic coast in Gaul, modern day France. They'll complete the conquest of Spain. There's a last burst of conquest under the first emperor, Augustus. You know, he's the fellow who's defeated Mark Antony and Cleopatra to make himself sole ruler of the empire. But it's there's no coincidence that really expansion stops after his death. He gives the Romans a few decades of continuous conquest, continuous victory to show that we're not fighting each other in civil wars anymore. We're going out, we're making Rome strong, we're making Rome safe against external threats, all this sort of thing. I'm giving you all this glory, isn't it wonderful? But there's no coincidence that men like Julius Caesar and his opponent Pompey the Great, others like Sulla and Marius, that the leaders in Rome's civil war that tore the Republic apart to the extent where the system failed and you ended up, people welcomed the certainty offered by someone like Augustus, who, you know, didn't avoid the name, but was effectively a military dictator. He's in charge because he controls the army. He's going to make very sure that nobody else gets to control the army. The men who be the great conquerors were also the leaders in the civil war. And this is one of the reasons why after Augustus, successive emperors that follow very rarely conquer anything. Britain under Claudius is one of the rare exceptions. The Emperor Trajan in the early second century will conquer Dacia, modern day Romania, try to make some conquests in the east. Most emperors don't like conquest because they've got a choice. Either they go off and lead the conquest on their own, which is a bit risky because you might get killed. It also takes you away from Rome for years on end, which means it's much harder to govern the rest of the empire. And what's going to happen in your absence? Are some senators going to get ideas about supplanting you? On the other hand, if you don't go in person and you give a Roman senator command of the army to go and conquer things, he's got an army he'll make loyal to him. He's going to win glory. He's going to win fame. He's going to win money. He could easily become the next Julius Caesar, the next Pompey, the next rival to you. So politically, the empire really doesn't, you know, the empresses don't like expansion, and it pretty much stops from AD 14. It helps that Augustus's successor, Tiberius, has already won so much military glory fighting on behalf of Augustus that he doesn't need to prove himself anymore, and he's really too old to care. Later emperors like Caligula, like Nero, aren't really interested in expansion. They prefer to stay in Rome or Italy. Claudius, who is made emperor when Caligula's just been murdered hours before, and the Praetorian Guard, the emperor's bodyguard, who need an emperor, any emperor, because otherwise they're not going to be anybody's guard, they're not going to be able to justify their high salaries, their comfortable lifestyle in Rome, find the emperor's uncle, Claudius, hiding behind a curtain in the imperial palace. Now, Claudius limps, he drools, he stammers. You know, you can think back to the old Robert Graves, I, Claudius, in the BBC drama. He's had no public career. People have wondered whether he was, you know, mentally unstable. He's got no military glory, and he's been made emperor in this very unconvincing situation where the guardsmen just proclaim him emperor because they need somebody. Probably no coincidence that he's the one that conquers Britain because he needs military glory. And then when the Emperor Trajan starts his conquest in the second century, he's been made emperor in circumstances after the murder of Domitian, and then Domitian's replaced by Nerva, an elderly senator who's sort of there as nobody's really got too much against him. It's deeply insecure. He adopts Trajan. Trajan has gone down in history as a great soldier, but up until that point that he becomes emperor, he hadn't really had much military experience at all. He didn't have any victories to boast about. So again, he goes off to try and unite the empire behind him through conquest. So you get these periodic bursts when, for political reasons, an emperor needs glory, the empire expands. But otherwise, it's really too dangerous for most emperors to risk it. There's also the factor that, rather like, you know, when they get to northern Britain, they look at what's outside the empire and think, well, really, financially, this is just not worth conquering. It's going to be difficult to do it because the locals are stubborn, they're determined, they're going to resist us, we're going to have spend on a big garrison, we'll probably be here for years and years, and what are we going to get in return? So there's always that balance between the two, but on the whole, things are discouraging emperors from expansion. And by the 3rd century AD, when civil war becomes so common, most emperors have got so many other things that are occupying their mind to survive, to fight against other Roman rivals, that there really isn't the energy, isn't the enthusiasm for conquest, and it simply stops. But even then, very little of the empire is lost until much, much later.
I may be reading way too much into this, but I can't help but also think about, as we talk about the expansion of the Roman Empire really happening, why we would still consider Rome to be a republic, and we won't get too much into this, but whether or not, you know, some people say it's a mixed form of government, had elements of democracy, but not a full-fledged democracy. But I can't help but also think about ancient Athens and the Athenian Empire that also spread while it was a democracy itself.
It's one of those strange things about the ancient world is that the democracies do tend to be very aggressive, particularly the big ones. In part because often the voters can see a benefit from this, and certainly the political class can see, especially in Rome, the opportunity for glory, for profit. It's one of the ironies that, as far as the wider provincial population were concerned, the creation of the empire and the rule of emperors was a really good thing. Because under the Republic, it was very difficult to protest against abuse by a governor. You had to send an embassy to Rome, wait for a senator to take up their case, then for the senator to raise that in the Senate, and then maybe at a later stage to bring a prosecution against that governor. You know, you've got these cases where men are using the money they've extorted from the provincials to bribe everyone to make sure this doesn't happen. Once you've got emperors, then anyone in the province believes that they can actually go to that emperor, and it might take years, they might have to queue up, but the emperor will listen to their problem. They know who it is they have to make a complaint to. And there's a marvelous story from the Greek geographer Strabo, writing in the early 1st century AD, where he talks about some islands off the coast of Greece that are so poor that their entire tax income for 1 year of the entire island is actually less than the value of a milk cow that we happen to know about from a nearly contemporary papyrus from Egypt. But a representative of these fishing villages comes on board the ship Strabo's traveling on past the island to go to the Emperor Augustus at Corinth and to wait his turn to ask to have their tax reduced. They can't even afford this, is the argument. Now, that man clearly believes, as do the communities that have sent him, that the emperor will eventually find the time to deal with their problem and will be sympathetic. There's the expectation that they'll actually, you know, they've got a fair chance of getting a good answer. And this is the pattern all the way through. You get the abuse of power by men like the procurator, who's, you know, provoked Boudicca into rebellion. But it's much, much harder to get away with it under the empire because the emperors don't want trouble. You know, it was much. There's some telling letters from the orator Cicero, who governed Cilicia in southern Turkey now in the first century, where his predecessor had stolen money wherever he could get it. He'd extorted money from the cities for all sorts of pretexts, behaved like a wild beast. In his private letters to friends, Cicero says how awful this is, how absolutely terrible. You know, the man's a monster. We also have Cicero's letters to the man himself, his predecessor, which are very, very polite, very restrained. There's the occasional sort of veiled criticism. But Cicero knew that this man was one of the most influential aristocrats in the Senate, and that for the rest of his life, he's going to have to sit next to this man and debate things with him. He doesn't want to upset him. So political influence, if you belong to the right family, if you had the right friends in Rome, you could get away with a huge amount under the Republic. You couldn't do that under the emperor because the emperor doesn't want that sort of behavior by his governors, because if it happens, you tend to end up, same result you have with Boudicca, you get a rebellion, and the emperor doesn't want rebellions. So it's an odd thing that, you know, almost is counterintuitive to us, but the end of democracy at Rome in any meaningful way is actually a lot better for the wider provincial population, in part because in the last few generations of the Republic, the aristocracy had so abused its power and so ignored serious problems because it was so busy with its own competition, its own infighting, that it hadn't dealt with things. So it's strange, but in the same way you get, you know, the assembly, the People's Assembly in Athens would often vote for very extreme, rather savage measures, was extremely willing to be aggressive, to attack people because they saw benefits to it. You know, we'd expect them to be a lot calmer, a lot nicer, but it doesn't seem to work that way.
I'm going to take a quick time out here. I have two more questions, but I want to make sure I respect your time because we were a little bit over time that we told you. Are you okay?
I'm okay, yep. If that's, I'll just have a quick drink there. That's all.
Yeah, take that drink. Tell me when you're ready.
There we go.
All right, and thank you. And we'll just maybe be 10 more minutes. Are you okay with that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
okay,
fine.
Great. Here we go. Let me jump back into this. 3, 2, 1. We are speaking to Adrian Goldsworthy. He is a historian of the classical world. He's the author of the book Hadrian's Wall. So it's called Hadrian's Wall. This is after the Emperor Hadrian. Who was Hadrian?
Hadrian's quite interesting because he's an emperor from Spain. He's the second one. Trajan, his predecessor, was also from Italica in Spain. But they're Roman citizens, and, you know, as far as the Romans are concerned, they're just as Roman as anybody else. And it's part of that trend. Later in the second century, you'll have the Emperor Septimius Severus, who come from North Africa, and he's the Roman emperor, but he's also a Roman citizen. Nobody ever comments at all on his appearance. There are a few snide comments we get about Hadrian having a rather provincial Spanish accent to his Latin, but in every other respect, he's considered to be just as Roman as everyone else. He wasn't a terribly popular emperor. He, in part because of his personality, he does seem to be one of those men who was very clever, very capable, but liked showing off and always liked to have the last word. And of course, you know, if you're emperor, you can get away with that, but it means people don't like you. It's also the circumstances when he became emperor were a little bit unusual in that it wasn't clear the Emperor Trajan had adopted him before he died. He orders the execution, or at least some leading senators are executed shortly afterwards. The emperor probably, Hadrian is probably the man who gave the order. So he's never liked by the Senate. And it's made worse in that Hadrian is the first emperor to wear a beard and to be overtly Greek. You know, he was obsessed with Greek philosophy, Greek ideas. he actually became a magistrate in Athens while he was emperor. Now, people had done that before they were emperor, but not at the same time. And, you know, a lot of what you see, a lot of the archaeology you see in Athens today was built by Hadrian. He even set up an arch in which he proclaimed, this is the city of Hadrian, not the city of Theseus, you know, Theseus, the mythical founder of Athens. So he likes to sort of see himself as this very sophisticated Greco-Roman, intelligent man, a little bit different. But he also has affairs with young men, particularly Antinous, this youth he watches. He's sort of supposed to be visiting this gymnasium and seeing the youngsters, the young men performing. And he falls in love with this fella and then has, you know, the Romans didn't really mind what people did privately, but publicly for the emperor to have an affair with a boy or a youth is considered, particularly the extent to which Hadrian paraded it. You know, there are loads of images of Antinous. When Antinous dies under slightly mysterious circumstances, drowning in Egypt, and he founds a whole city named after him, it's all seen as, you know, a little bit too much for decent Roman behavior, if you can use such a thing. So it combines. Probably if Hadrian had been popular in other respects, he could have got away with that and people would have still liked him. But because they didn't like him in the first place, you have this sort of snowball effect. Anything someone then does will be that much more annoying to all the people who already don't like him. He also abandoned some of Trajan's conquered territory in the east. So that's a big change. That seems a little bit shameful. But he is a very active emperor. Compared to everybody back as far as Augustus, he is the only emperor who starts to travel anywhere near as much as Augustus and spends most of his reign visiting virtually every province of the empire, including Britain. Comes to Britain in 122. He likes building things. He's obsessed with architecture. So there's probably something of the stamp of Hadrian on the wall that the Romans called the Vallum Aelium, the wall of Aelius was Hadrian's family name. You know, the reason it's so big, it's on such a grand scale compared to all the other frontiers of the Roman Empire. There's nothing as elaborate as this. Probably has a lot to do with Hadrian. On the other hand, what he built tended to be practical. You've only got to go to the Pantheon in Rome today, you know, which later turned into a church, where you could still walk under that huge dome ceiling. And it's an incredible building. You know, that was Hadrian's design, one of Hadrian's projects. His villa at Tivoli is this sort of incredible extravaganza of all the different sort of glimpses of all over the empire. So, yes, he likes his grand projects, but they also tend to be quite well thought out, quite practical. So there is probably a lot of the personal stamp of Hadrian on Britain. And he was the first emperor to come to Britain since Claudius had come very, very briefly for about 10 days after the initial conquest in AD 43. So, you know, it's part of his tour of the empire, but it also shows a practical interest in getting the empire to work, making the frontiers work, in showing himself to the army, doing all these sorts of things. So he's an interesting man, but again, not quite as bad as the nature of the wall itself. But we don't have very good sources for Hadrian. Mm-hmm. Even though he's important, even though his images are quite common, the literary sources for the second century AD are extremely poor, which means that we're relying on the sort of accounts written centuries later that we'd normally prefer to avoid, but there is simply nothing better. So trying to get to the real Hadrian is as difficult as it is almost anybody else in the Roman world.
Yet he's considered one of the, I think, five emperors that spanned this Pax Romana period, the Roman peace, considered the golden era of the Roman
he's
Empire.
He's singled out by Gibbon in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire as one of the five good emperors that, again, and it is abundantly clear that most of the greatest monuments of the wider Roman Empire, not necessarily Rome itself, for there are some there like the Pantheon, but many of the other big monuments are built in this period. The empire seems particularly prosperous in the second century. It probably has a bigger population than at any other point. You can look back even to it's a bit two-edged, but there was the analysis of samples from the polar ice caps a few years ago that found that in the first and particularly the second century AD, there was more industrial activity and hence more pollution at this period of the height of the Roman Empire than there would be again until the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, they were even capable, or it shows how much human activity is going on, even if some of it's having an adverse effect. So the empire is prosperous, it's stable, it has a period where there's no threat of civil war, and Hadrian, you know, is probably a very good ruler, but as I say, he just didn't have that sort of personality that could make people like him. And the Senate even thinks twice about deifying him after his death, which was the normal mark of sort of you approved of somebody's reign. You showed they were a good emperor by proclaiming they were a god as soon as they died. Hadrian's successor, Antoninus Pius, has to force the Senate to do this because they initially weren't too keen. But as soon as they see his successor wants this, then okay, fair enough, yes, we'll do it. So yes, I mean, he's a mixed figure. One suspects he was, you know, a very good ruler. As were most of them within the circumstance of the Roman Empire. And certainly this is a period of great prosperity, and it's before the Antonine plagues, and it's before the civil wars of the 3rd century onwards. But we'd love to know more about what was really going on and have more of a sense of why he's doing a lot of what he's doing in the various provinces he visits.
Adrian Goldsworthy has been our guest. Again, Adrian Goldsworthy is a renowned historian of the classical world. He's the author of a number of books. He has joined us to talk about his latest. It's called Hadrian's Wall. Adrian Goldsworthy, I've enjoyed our conversation a great deal, and I thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been fun.
And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of useful consciousness. Money as debt. In the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, the role of banks and their future should be placed under scrutiny. In TUC Radio's last program, you heard the soundtrack of an independent movie by Paul Grignon, Money as Debt. In part one, Grignon explained the curious phenomenon that money comes into being as debt whenever a loan or mortgage is signed. The bank, with a stroke of a keyboard, creates out of nothing the amount of that loan as a credit in the borrower's account, simply based on the promise of the borrower to pay. Part 1 ended with a quote that, "We are totally dependent on continually renewed bank credit for there to be any money in existence. No loans, no money, which is what happened in the Great Depression." End quote. The second half of Money as Debt that you are about to hear now begins with another important issue. The borrower needs to promise to pay back the loan with interest. Where does that money come from? Here's the narrator, Bob Bossen.
Banks create only the amount of the principal. They don't create the money to pay the interest. Where is that supposed to come from? The only place borrowers can go to obtain the money to pay interest is the general economy's overall money supply. But almost all that overall money supply has been created exactly the same way, as bank credit that has to be paid back with more than was created. So everywhere there are other borrowers in the same situation, frantically trying to obtain the money they need to pay back both principal and interest from a total money pool which contains only principal. It is clearly impossible for everyone to pay back the principal plus interest because the interest money doesn't exist. This can even be expressed by a simple mathematical formula. The big problem here is that for long-term loans, such as mortgages and government debt, the total interest far exceeds the principal. So unless a lot of extra money is created to pay the interest, it means a very high proportion of foreclosures and a non-functioning economy. To maintain a functional society, the rate of foreclosure needs to be low. And so, to accomplish this, more and more new debt money has to be created to satisfy today's demands for money to service the previous debt. But of course, this just makes the total debt bigger, and that means more interest must ultimately be paid, resulting in an ever-escalating and inescapable spiral of mounting indebtedness. It is only the time lag between money's creation as new loans and its repayment that keeps the overall shortage of money from catching up and bankrupting the entire system. However, as the bank's insatiable credit monster gets bigger and bigger, the need to create more and more debt money to feed it becomes increasingly urgent. Why are interest rates so low? Why do we get unsolicited credit cards in the mail? Why is the U.S. government spending faster than ever? Could it be to stave off collapse of the entire monetary system? A rational person has to ask, can this really go on forever? Isn't a collapse inevitable?
One thing to realize about our fractional reserve banking system is that, like a child's game of musical chairs, as long as the music is playing, there are no losers. Andrew Gauss, monetary historian.
Money facilitates production and trade. As the money supply increases, money just becomes increasingly worthless unless the volume of production and trade in the real world grows by the same amount. Add to this the realization that when we hear that the economy is growing at 3% per year, it sounds like a constant rate, but it's not. This year's 3% represents more real goods and services than last year's 3% because it's 3% of the new total. Instead of a straight line, as is naturally visualized from the words, it is really an exponential curve getting steeper and steeper. The problem, of course, is that perpetual growth of the real economy requires perpetually escalating use of real-world resources and energy. More and more stuff has to go from natural resource to garbage every year, forever, just to keep this system from collapsing.
Anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. Kenneth Boulding, economist.
What can we do about this downright scary situation? For one thing, we need a very different concept of money. It's time more people asked themselves and their governments four simple questions. Around the world, governments borrow money at interest from private banks. Government debt is a major component of total debt, and servicing that debt takes a big chunk of our taxes. Now, we know that banks simply create the money they lend, and that governments have given them permission to do this. So the first question is, why do governments choose to borrow money from private banks at interest when government could create all the interest-free money it needs itself? And the second big question is, why create money as debt at all? Why not create money that circulates permanently and doesn't have to be perpetually reborrowed at interest in order to exist? The third question, how can a money system that can only function with perpetually accelerating growth be used to build a sustainable economy? Isn't it logical that perpetually accelerating growth and sustainability are incompatible? And finally, what is it about our current system that makes it totally dependent on perpetual growth? What needs to be changed to allow the creation of a sustainable economy? At one time, charging any interest on a loan was called usury and was subject to severe penalties, including death. Every major religion forbade usury. Most of the arguments made against the practice were moral. It was held that money's only legitimate purpose was to facilitate the exchange of real goods and services. Any form of making money from simply having money was regarded as the act of a parasite or of a thief. However, as the credit needs of commerce increased, the moral arguments eventually gave way to the argument that lending involves risk and loss of opportunity to the lender, and therefore attempting to make a profit from lending is justified. Today, these notions seem quaint. Today, the idea of making money from money is held as an ideal to strive for. Why work when you can get your money to work for you? However, in trying to envision a sustainable future, it's very clear that the charging of interest is both a moral and a practical problem. Imagine a society and economy that can endure for centuries because, instead of plundering its capital stores of energy, it restricts itself to present-day income. No more wood is harvested than grows in the same period. All energy is renewable. Solar, gravitational, geothermal, magnetic, and whatever else we discover. This society lives within the limits of its non-renewable resources by reusing and recycling everything, and the population just replaces itself. Such a society could never function using a money system utterly dependent on perpetually accelerating growth. A stable economy would need a money supply at least capable of remaining stable without collapsing. Let's say the total volume of this stable money supply is represented by this big circle. Let's also imagine that money lenders must actually have existing money to lend. If some people within this money supply begin systematically lending money at interest, their share of the money supply will grow. If they continually re-loan at interest all the money that gets paid back, what's the inevitable result? Whether it's gold, fiat, or debt money doesn't matter. The money lenders will end up with all the money. And after the foreclosures and bankruptcies are all filed, they'll get all the real property too. Only if the proceeds of lending at interest were evenly distributed among the population would this central problem be solved. Heavy taxation of bank profits might accomplish this goal, but then why would banks want to be in business? If we were ever able to free ourselves of the current situation, we could imagine banking run as a non-profit service to society, dispersing its interest earnings as a universal citizen dividend, or lending without charging interest at all.
I have never yet had anyone who could, through the use of logic and reason, justify the federal government borrowing the use of its own money. I believe the time will come when people will demand that this be changed. I believe the time will come in this country when they will actually blame you and me and everyone else connected with Congress for sitting idly by and permitting such an idiotic system to continue. Congressman Wright Patman.
If it is the fundamental nature of the system that causes the problems, tinkering with the system cannot ever solve those problems. The system itself must be replaced. Many monetary critics call for a return to gold-based money, claiming that gold has a long history of reliability. They ignore the many scams that can be played with gold, shaving coins, debasing the metal, cornering the market, all of which were abundantly practiced in ancient Rome and contributed to its fall. Some advocate silver, it being more abundant than gold and therefore more difficult to corner. Many question the need to bring back precious metals at all. No one wants to go back to carrying heavy sacks of coins to go shopping. It's a certainty that paper, digital, plastic, or more likely biometric ID money would be the real medium of trade with the same potential for creating unlimited debt money we have now. Beyond that, if gold again became the sole legal basis of money, those who have no gold would suddenly have no money. Other monetary reform advocates have concluded that greed and dishonesty are the main problems, and that there may be better ways to create an honest and equitable money system than returning to silver or gold. Inventive minds have proposed a variety of alternate ways to create money. Many private barter systems create money as debt, much as banks do, but it is done openly and without charging interest. An example is a barter system in which debt is expressed as pledges of hours of work, all work being valued equally at a dollar figure that then allows hours to be equated with the dollar price of goods. This kind of money system can be set up by anyone who can devise a way to do the accounting and find willing and trustworthy participants. Setting up a local barter money system, even if it were little used now, would be prudent emergency planning for any community. Monetary reform, like electoral reform, is a big topic, and one that requires a willingness to change and to think outside the box. Monetary reform, again, like electoral reform, will not come easily, because the enormously powerful interests that benefit from the existing system will do their utmost to maintain their advantage. Now that we've seen that money is just an idea, and that in reality money can be whatever we make it, here's one very simple alternative monetary concept to consider. This model is based on systems that have worked in the past, in England and America, systems that were undermined and destroyed by the goldsmith bankers and their fractional reserve system. To create an economy based on permanent interest-free money, money could simply be created and spent into the economy by the government, preferably on long-lasting infrastructure that facilitates the economy, such as roads, railroads, bridges, harbors, and public markets. This money would not be created as debt, it would be created as value, that value being in the form of whatever it was spent on. If this new money facilitated a proportional increase in trade requiring its use, it would cause no inflation whatsoever. If government spending did cause inflation, there would be two courses of action available. Inflation is equivalent in effect to a flat tax on money. Whether the money goes down in value 20% or the government takes 20% of our money away from us, the effect on our buying power is the same. Viewed this way, inflation in place of taxation might be politically acceptable if well spent and kept within limits. Or government could choose to counter inflation by collecting tax monies that it then takes out of use, thus reducing the money supply and restoring its value. To control deflation, which is the phenomenon of falling wages and prices, the government would simply spend more money into existence. With no competing private debt money creation, governments would have more effective control of their nation's money supply. The public would know whom to blame if things went wrong. Governments would rise and fall on their ability to preserve the value of money. Government would operate primarily on taxes as it does now, but tax money would go much, much further as none of it would be required to pay interest to private bankers. There could be no national debt if the federal government simply created the money it needed. Our perpetual collective servitude to the banks through interest payments on government debt would be impossible.
Money is a new form of slavery and distinguishable from the old simply by the fact that it is impersonal, that there is no human relation between master and slave. Leo Tolstoy. None are more enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free. Goethe.
What we have been taught to believe as democracy and freedom has become in reality an ingenious and invisible form of economic dictatorship. As long as our entire society remains utterly dependent on bank credit for its supply of money, bankers will be in the position to make the decisions on who gets the money they need and who doesn't.
The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. Bankers own the earth. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with a flick of the pen, they will create enough money to buy it back again. Take this great power away from them, and all great fortunes, like mine, will disappear, and they ought to disappear, for then this would be a better and happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be slaves of the banks and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let bankers continue to create money and control credit. Sir Josiah Stamp, Director, Bank of England, 1928 to 1941.
Few people are aware today that the history of the United States since the Revolution in 1776 has been, in large part, the story of an epic struggle to get free and stay free of control by the European international banks. This struggle was finally lost in 1913, when President Woodrow Wilson signed into effect the Federal Reserve Act, putting the international banking cartel in charge of creating America's money.
I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all our activities are in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled and one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men. Woodrow Wilson.
The power of this system is deeply ingrained. So is the educational and media silence on the subject. Years ago, Canadian Deputy Prime Minister surveyed scores of non-economists, both highly educated professionals and common sense people on the street, and found that not one of them had an accurate understanding of how money is created. In fact, it's probably safe to say that most people, including the frontline employees of banks, have never given the matter a moment's thought. Have you?
All of the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arises not from the defects of the Constitution or Confederation, not from want of honor or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. John Adams, founding father of the American Constitution.
The modern money as debt system was born a little over 300 years ago, when the first Bank of England was set up with a royal charter for fractional lending of gold receipts at a modest ratio of 2-1. That modest ratio was just the proverbial foot in the door. The system is now worldwide, creates virtually unlimited amounts of money out of thin air, and has almost everyone on the planet chained to a perpetually growing debt that can never be paid off. Could it have all happened by accident? Or is it a conspiracy? Obviously, something very big is at stake here.
Whoever controls the volume of money in our country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled, one way or another, by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate. James A. Garfield, assassinated President of the United States. The government should create, issue, and circulate all the currency and credits needed to satisfy the spending power of the government and the buying power of consumers. By the adoption of these principles, the taxpayers will be saved immense sums of interest. The privilege of creating and issuing money is not only the supreme prerogative of government, but it is the government's greatest creative opportunity. Abraham Lincoln, assassinated President of the United States. Until the control of the issue of currency and credit is restored to government and recognized as its most conspicuous and sacred responsibility, all talk of sovereignty of parliament and of democracy is idle and futile. Once a nation parts with control of its credit, it matters not who makes the nation's laws. Usury, once in control, will wreck any nation. William Lyon Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada, who nationalized the Bank of Canada. We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected the promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity during those years. But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government, the supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national auto-determination practiced in past centuries. David Rockefeller, in an address to a trilateral commission meeting in June of 1991. Only the small secrets need to be protected. The big ones are kept secret by public incredulity. Marshall McLuhan, media guru. That was the second part of the soundtrack of the film Money as Debt by the independent filmmaker Paul Grignon. The film was made in 2006 and has become one of the really positive phenomena on the internet. You can hear this program again by going to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, or by searching for the film Money as Debt on the internet. Money as Debt has a huge, ongoing international response and has been translated into Spanish, German, Dutch, Italian, Serbian, Slovenian, Czech, Bulgarian, Polish, Russian, and Japanese. The website of the film is moneyasdebt.net. The site is an excellent resource. You can find the script and all the quotes in the film with their sources. Their reviews, responses to criticism, and praise from well-known and knowledgeable people such as Catherine Austin Fitz, Hazel Henderson, and David Corton. Since 2006, Paul Guignol has produced two sequels. Money as Debt 2 deals with bailouts, stimulus packages, and how to escape an ever-growing debt. Money as Debt 3 is about creating a nurturing economy. All his films are now available from his website, moneyasdebt.net. If you really rather have an audio copy of Money as Debt, download it from my website or call 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get TUC Radio CDs by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. And many thanks to Paul Guignol for making the soundtrack of his film available. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time to save the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
This is Doug Brown, and we are on Unusual Sources, 93.3 FM, broadcasting out of McMaster University. You can be heard also online at cfmu.ca. And I'm joining Brendan Stone today, and we're going to begin the show looking at the issue of Kashmir. A terrible situation, a terribly long period of unrest, conflict, injustice, brutality, and you know, this is all started with the independence of India and the partition of India and Pakistan way back in 1947. So you know, the corporate media really tells us hardly anything about what's going on. We fortunately have, through our show and the Taylor Report, we've had a number of good discussions with Phil Taylor interviewing Bashir Bangat, or Zafar Bangish. Zafar has worked tirelessly on the Kashmir issue. And so right here in Hamilton, we've had some activity. In fact, our very own Ken Stone, community activist, activists for the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, and other good causes. Ken last year went to Pakistan, then went to Azad Kashmir, the part that's controlled by Pakistan, and was at a conference and saw a lot of what was going on. But more than that, just personal observations. There's been just released a report, a UN report on the situation. So we're going to have a look at that. Ken's joined us in the studio. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, Doug.
Okay, well, it's great to have you on. And Ken, the start of the issue in Kashmir, I was a preschooler at the time, and you might not have even been born. But can you give us a little bit of background on Kashmir and how we've arrived at this situation to date?
I'll do my best, Doug. You're right to say that the problem started way back in 1947 with the British partition of the Indian subcontinent into two countries, India and Pakistan. And at that time, the idea was that predominantly Muslim states would go with Pakistan and predominantly Hindu states would go with India. Now, in the north, there is a large state called, it was a princely state called Jammu and Kashmir, and it was overwhelmingly Muslim. And the ruler, the prince, happened to be Hindu. And at first, he decided he wanted to be independent. And so he never consulted, of course, his own population, which was overwhelmingly Muslim, as I said. And immediately, the Muslim population started to become active, organize, demonstrate, and take up arms because they wanted to join Pakistan. And when this happened, the prince got cold feet, and he called on India to help him out to save his bacon, and he wanted to join India. So the Indian army, the Indian government, sent in the Indian army, and there were terrible massacres of Muslim civilians. Nobody even knows how many tens of thousands were martyred at the time. And in the fighting, the Muslim forces, supported by the new government of Pakistan, was gaining the upper hand. And the Indian government thought that they were going to lose the whole thing. So they appealed to the new United Nations organization. And they went to the Security Council and asked for the help of the Security Council in resolving this situation. So it was India who went to the Security Council. And it just so happened that at that time, Canada was a member of the UN Security Council. In fact, the president of the Security Council was General McNaughton, who was a hero of World War II. And he took a personal interest in this issue, and he helped to work out what was a very democratic solution, and a very simple solution, which was to give a vote to the people of Jammu and Kashmir on their political future. It was called an impartial political plebiscite, or what we would call today a referendum. And the United Nations Security Council, passed a number of resolutions in early 1948, and they all centered around this one idea: give the people of Jammu and Kashmir a referendum on their political future. And the Indian government, of the Pakistani government, immediately accepted that. And the Indian government also accepted it and said that they would implement it as soon as there were peaceful conditions prevailing. And so what happened was the Indian government never followed through on this promise. And there has never been a referendum. So Jammu and Kashmir have been divided along what's called the line of control, which was the armistice line, 1948. On one side, the western side, the Pakistani government is in charge, It's called Azad Kashmir, or Free Kashmir. And on the other side is Indian-occupied Kashmir, which is the two-thirds of the territory. And on that side, there has been an occupation that has been going on for 71 years. Almost, it's a little bit longer than the occupation of Palestine by the Zionist regime. And it is, in every case, as repressive or even more repressive than the regime, the Zionist regime has been to the Palestinians. In those 71 years, the Indian government has tried to intensify its hold on Jammu and Kashmir. They have brought in what is now amounts to an army of 1 million in occupation, 700,000 troops, and about 200,000 or 300,000 police are situated in Kashmir and have been there for decades. So there are about, I can't remember if it's 13 million or 16 million people who live in the Indian-occupied Kashmir, and 1 million occupation troops. The bulk of the Indian army is in Kashmir. You can imagine the cost in terms of finances for the Indian government. But on top of that, there is what the there is a catastrophic human rights situation that prevails in Kashmir, Indian-occupied Kashmir, which includes, since 1989, over 100,000 Kashmiris who have been killed by the Indian government. There have been tens of thousands of people who have disappeared, no trace, but there have been mass graves recently found. There have been thousands of people who are in jails, including children. There has been a campaign of mass rapes against women in Indian-occupied Kashmir, over 11,000 cases documented. And for all these huge crimes against humanity, war crimes, there has not been one single Indian soldier or police officer who has ever been prosecuted for any of these crimes. So we have a terrible, probably one of the worst human rights situations on the entire planet, and you know nobody knows about it over here in the Western world. No, it's not covered in the media. The Canadian government hasn't said a word about it in decades, so in the peace movement, we have decided to pick up this cause. And we have also done this because of a situation which is important to the peace movement, and that is the fact that, counting the partition, there have now been three wars between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. First during the partition, 47-48, and then twice afterwards. And in those last two wars, 27,150 combatants were killed and hundreds of thousands were injured. Today, along the line of control, according to the High Commissioner's report, one of the points in the High Commissioner's report, one of his major points, in fact his very first point, is that since July of 2016, and especially since January of this year, there have been sharp rises in the number of ceasefire violations along the line of control, which means that there are skirmishes, artillery duels along the line of control, which could easily flare up into another war. But the situation today is different than it has been in the past. Both India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons, and lots of them, hundreds of them each. Pakistan has gone to the point that it has given over to its generals in the field the control of tactical nuclear weapons. Now, these sound like small weapons, not going to cause much damage. But many of these weapons have the potential of 10, 20, 50, 100 times what was dropped by the U.S. on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 70 years ago. And moreover, 73 years ago. And moreover, the Indian government has, scores of planes, ships, and missile sites from which to launch its nuclear weapons against Pakistan. So if there were a war in which even only a few of these weapons were used, the future of humanity, the future of civilization would be very much in doubt. The natural environment would be made uninhabitable for the world. So this is an issue of world peace, and that's why the peace movement, in this case, the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, that's why we support the Friends of Kashmir, and we support the call for peace in Kashmir through the implementation of the UN resolutions of 70 years ago. There's no need for a new formula for peace. If only the countries of the world, if only the United Nations would impose on India today the demand that you need to hold a referendum, you need to pull out your troops, and you need to have a referendum among the people of Jammu and Kashmir. Let them decide their future, India or Pakistan. Let's get this festering sore resolved, and let's reduce the chance of Armageddon.
Right. Very serious situation. I mean, just the current human rights situation in occupied Kashmir should warrant worldwide attention. But the potential of a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, I mean, this is of such grave consequence. Surely Canada and other countries have a stake in this, and we should really be doing all we can as a country to resolve the situation. And as you mentioned, the solution has been sitting in front of us since 1948.
Absolutely.
Hold a referendum. We are a democratic country. We profess to believe in democracy. Let's let democracy play out. Well, some interesting developments locally. The president of Azad Kashmir, the part of Kashmir that's under Pakistan control, is in Canada, and he has made a few appearances. One very locally, one in Hamilton just on Sunday. You spoke at that one. I was in the audience, can you tell us a little bit about the visit and what impact you're hoping this will have?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. The president of Azad Kashmir is his name is Masood Khan. He's a career diplomat. He was elected president of Azad Kashmir. That's the part that's in Pakistan, as you mentioned, 2 years ago. I met him personally last year, January of 2017. There was a conference held in Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. It was organized by the Young Parliamentarians of India. Those are all the parliamentarians of all parties under 40 years old. And they had a conference on Kashmir. And they invited parliamentarians from the UK and from the European Union, and they invited peace activists such as myself and Muslim scholars such as Zafar Bangash, and they had hundreds of young Pakistani activists and students in attendance, and the media, of course. And in the course of that conference, the president of Azad Kashmir invited us, all the delegates, to a media conference in his residence in Islamabad. And so the media from all over South Asia was there. And we talked about why Kashmiris need a referendum. And following that media conference, President Khan arranged for some of us delegates to go and visit Azad Kashmir following the conference, and I was one of the lucky ones who got to go. So we went to Azad Kashmir, and we were surprised to say the least, about how interested the people in Azad Kashmir are in the situation on the other side of the line of control. There were three events that we participated in Azad Kashmir. And one was a welcome reception in Muzaffarabad, the capital, at which everybody, including the kitchen staff and the wait staff, came out and had an opinion about the future of Kashmir. The next day there was a meeting at the University of Azad Kashmir in Muzaffarabad, at which the people, the students, came out on very short notice, hundreds of them, to hear what we Westerners had to say and also to express their own opinions about the situation. The government and the university administration, of course, are for the referendum, and they made their points very clear. And then after that, we went to a refugee camp on the outskirts of Muzaffarabad where people who escaped were made refugees from an uprising against Indian occupied rule. Indian rule 30 years ago were living in a refugee camp. And those people had things to say too. So I think I went around your question a bit, but your question had to do with Canada, why Canada hasn't said anything about that. Canada has let the ball drop. The government of Canada has let the ball drop. The Canadian government has been trying to cozy up to the government in India because they look at the government of India, look at the country of India as a vast potential market for Canadian goods and services. And so they have put aside the good work that General McNaughton and the Canadian delegation at the United Nations did in 1947, and they would prefer not to hear about that anymore. However, the interesting part about the meeting that you described in Stony Creek was that one of the speakers at the meeting was our MP from Hamilton Mountain, Scott Duvall, who is a representative of the New Democratic Party. And he got up and he made a commitment that he would try to raise at the Human Rights Committee of Parliament the issue of Kashmir. And for his part, the president of Azad Kashmir, Mr. Khan, made a commitment that he was willing to come back to Canada in October of this year in order to appear before the Human Rights Committee of Parliament and talk about the situation in Indian-occupied Kashmir. So I'm glad to see that there's finally some movement, that there will hopefully be in the Parliament of Canada some discussion about the situation in Kashmir. In England, there is an all-party committee on Kashmir, and they talk about Kashmir all the time. Liberals, Tories, and Labour, they're always talking about Kashmir in the British Parliament. And it's high time that we did the same here. So I think it's a good development. And the report, the context for this is the High Commissioner's report on human rights in Kashmir.
Yeah. Yeah, kudos to Scott Duvall for, taking a lead in Parliament. As you say, it's just been ignored. To finally see an MP, and I hope he's joined by others, to get Canada to look at the situation and put pressure obviously the pressure is needed on India to allow a referendum and resolve this terrible situation once and for all. But with regard to the terrible things that have been going on during the occupation, the very recently released UN High Commission report, could you give us some of the highlights that came out of that report?
Yes, I can, actually. I've got it in front of me here on the screen. And it's a report It's a report by the High Commissioner for the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. And it's called The Report on the Situation of Human Rights in Kashmir. You can get it off the website of the High Commissioner at the United Nations. It's a 49-page report, and it in about 45 pages of those 49 pages, the High Commissioner looks at some of the most glaring problems of the Indian occupation, and under the following subject headings, and I'll just read them off. Excessive use of force, killings perpetrated in 2018, use of pellet-firing shotguns, arbitrary arrests and detentions, including of children, torture, enforced disappearances, violations of the right to health, restrictions on the right to freedom of expression, reprisals against human rights defenders and restrictions on journalists, violations of the right to education, sexual violence, administrative detention. So in his report, the commissioner lays out all these horrible crimes against humanity and, in fact, war crimes, crimes against the Geneva Convention, to which Canada, by the way, was a high consenting party in 1949. Canada was one of the countries that drafted the 1949 Convention on the Rights of People in Occupied Territories. So the report is the first report of its kind that the UN Security Council, the UN has released about human rights violations in Kashmir in 70 years. And I have to say that it wouldn't have happened. This report would never have been printed were it not for the efforts, the tireless efforts of Dr. Zafar Bangash, who is a Canadian imam of a mosque near Markham, Ontario, in Richmond Hill. And what Zafar did, and Zafar is not a Kashmiri, he is originally from Pakistan. What he did was, with the help of the Friends of Kashmir, which, as you know, Doug, were an integral part of the former Canadian Peace Alliance in Canada, to which the Hamilton Coalition used to belong when it was when the alliance was alive. What they did was they started a petition to the High Commissioner asking him to do a report. And they were initially trying to get 15,000 signatures worldwide. They ended up getting 50,000 signatures worldwide. They wrote an appeal, a public appeal to the Commissioner, and lo and behold, he responded in a positive way. And he tried to go into Indian-occupied Kashmir, but the Indian government would not let him. He asked for permission from Azad Kashmir, from President Khan, and he got permission. But because he couldn't get into Indian-occupied Kashmir, he decided he would do a study by remotely, by taking the facts and figures that were being recorded by human rights organizations on the ground. And he compiled this into a report, and the report is absolutely damning. I don't know if you've had time to read it, Doug, but it's absolutely damning on the government of India. In the last three or four pages, the commissioner also looks at Azad Kashmir and finds a few problems. But he says there's no comparison between the catastrophic situation in Indian-occupied Kashmir as opposed to Azad Kashmir. And then the very first recommendation that the commissioner makes at the end of this report is that there be a commission of inquiry that goes into Indian-occupied Kashmir and into Azad Kashmir, a fact-finding commission, to see about the situation on the ground. And at the two talks that I was at, two welcome banquets for the president in Mississauga and Stony Creek, President Khan said that he would welcome a commission of inquiry into Azad Kashmir. But so far, the Indian government has steadfastly refused to let such a commission come into their occupation zone.
Great. Now, you mentioned actually in your talk in Stony Creek, In fact, you use the a slogan, I think it was from Kashmir to Palestine, you know,
Occupation
is a crime.
Right.
Because there seems to be some parallels, certainly in the timing and in the situation of partition and then abuse of the occupied territories. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
There is a strong parallel between the occupation of Palestine and the occupation of Kashmir. I think these may be the last couple of occupations that still exist in this world, occupations of people who've been colonialized. As you know, when the UN was formed, it was partly to decolonize those colonies that had been held in the thrall of the imperial powers, U.S., Britain, France, Spain, Italy, after the Second World War. But the people of Palestine never got to be free, and the people of Indian-occupied Kashmir never got to be free either. And instead, what has happened is that the people in both those places have become increasingly repressed and marginalized and victimized by the occupying powers. And, you know, very little has been done by the UN to rectify these situations. And a lot of resolutions have been passed at the UN about Palestine, hardly any about Kashmir, but nothing much has been done for the people of Palestine, even in all those years. And certainly very little information about Kashmir even gets out to the outside world. And we know very little about it here in Canada, and it's very similar to the situation that the knowledge about Palestine, the level of knowledge about Palestine, about 40 years ago, before the anti-war movement and the Palestine Solidarity Movement got started. In those days, you never heard about Palestine, and today, we still don't hear in the West about Kashmir. And, of course, it's time that these illegal occupations were ended.
That's for sure. So, Ken, thank you very much for coming in. The first step is knowing about the situation. Kudos to you and Zafar Bangash, Phil Taylor, others working on the issue, and we'll be continuing to cover this as time goes on. So we're going to take a short break right now, but stay tuned. We have more programming coming up shortly on Unusual Sources.